Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 47 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games coming to you from the gaming capital of the world, Indianapolis, Indiana.
Vuvuzela free.
That's enough. That's enough vuvuzela.
You know, we were just going to put a vuvuzela track over the whole episode.
Yeah,
you know, just to simulate the experience.
Yeah. To me, it sounds like bees or insects or something.
Yeah. And apparently, there's hacks online about, you know, I think the BBC offered a vuvuzela free feed of the really? England soccer match. Yeah,
well, I never really watched World Cup soccer before until that England US match. Mm-hmm. And when I heard it for the first time, I'm like, what? What is this soccer? I'm no wonder I don't watch soccer. Yeah. So I didn't know it was just something in South Africa.
Conversely, I've read my Soccer for Dummies book. I've been enjoying the matches.
Uh-huh.
The US has already been eliminated, so
by Ghana. Was it Ghana?
Yeah, stupid Ghana. They did it in 06 too, apparently.
Really?
So,
okay.
So good for them. I have no horse in the race now. There's no Scotland team, no US team. So
who's the favorite now?
Oh, Germany?
Okay.
Brazil? I don't know.
No.
Okay. Yeah, let's go with that.
Awesome. Hey, let's talk about some games we know something about. So in this episode of Game On, we've kind of got a whole mishmash of stuff we're going to be talking about.
We've got
the Origins wrap up.
Yeah, John has returned home safely from Origins.
Yep, and so I'm going to be talking to you about that and give you a little footage from what I did in Origins in Columbus, Ohio. And then in our big deal, we've got a interview with a game publisher. Stephen Bonacore from Stronghold Games. We're going to be talking to him about his new gaming venture. And, you know, we're always a podcast that likes to sort of stick up for the little guy.
A champion for the small publisher.
Yep. And we want to get the word out. And so we want to definitely bring that to you. And also going to be talking to some designers during the Origins thing. And what do we got in By Trier tonight?
We have got a game sequel.
Yes.
Which is odd.
That is odd.
That was a dramatic pause. Uh-huh. This is World Without End, the sequel, I use air quotes there, to Pillars of the Earth,
right,
which is a novel by Ken Follett, same with World Without End. So we're going to see if it's about the same, good, bad.
Who knows? We'll talk about
There's a cathedral.
Yeah. But as always, we're going to kick off the episode with the Game On Inbox, which starts
promptly. The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com. What is the Game On Inbox, your best source of gaming news and information? But as always, to start off, a word from our sponsor.
That's right. Game On with Cody and John is proudly sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional gaming stores everywhere.
Everywhere.
I hope it's proudly sponsored. I will assume it is proudly sponsored.
I'm going to assume the pride
Thanks,
is there.
This is a little love we want to give to Myriad Games as they celebrate their 100th episode of their podcast, Myriad Games Presentations.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a golf clap.
That's good. That's a good job.
Well done.
That's 53 more than we have.
That's right. You know, so in 5 years when we reach that milestone, we got 50 coming up.
That'll be good.
The golden episode.
Sure.
But anyway, back about Myriad. Definitely give Myriad Game Presentations a listen if you haven't already. They have a kind of a cool roundtable format. It's like you're sitting with a bunch of your gaming friends talking about the new hotness in games.
And you know, their most recent episode of Session Impressions is about the game Dixit.
Dexit.
And a little interesting piece of news about Dexit is that it actually has been named as the winner of the Spiel des Jahres.
Oh, they announced that.
They did.
Oh,
did you not know?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so that was announced as the winner there.
That was
a
fun game.
So nice and timely for Myriad Games there. So go check out that review of Dexit on Myriad Games Presentations.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we'll continue on and start talking about games we've been playing. Cody, what have you been playing?
Well, while John was at Origins and having a ton of fun.
We'll get to that later.
My wife and I decided to host a kind of Origins replacement gaming. Neither of us could go this year. We had some friends in the area that couldn't either. So we decided just to invite some people over, and we played a ton of games. We played everything from Flux to Battlestar Galactica to Loop and Louie, Kingsburg, all sorts of good stuff.
Wow.
And I actually made my first geek list on BoardGameGeek. If you check out our guild, number 576, you can see a link to that, and you can see all the fun games we played.
Awesome.
There you go.
Very cool. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay, so check out the geek list if you want to hear more about the stuff.
I'm going to direct people to the guild.
Very good. Less work for us.
That's right.
We're not going to actually have any content on the show. We'll just direct people to various websites.
I've got one other thing. I finally finished my D&D 4th edition game.
Oh.
And it went well.
What was the final big bad?
Orcus, the demon prince of the undead.
Oh, yes. Very nice.
It was a big fight. It was a knockdown, drag-out thing, but the heroes were triumphant.
Now, was it a real knockdown dragout, or was it like a descent knockdown dragout where they've built up so much crap, you know, and so much gear that, you know, four blows and he's dead? And
it was kind of half and half. Is the first half of the battle, they were just owning him. Mm-hmm. Because in fourth edition, you know, parlance, they were using all of their daily powers. They were using their biggest guns early.
Sure.
And they just whittled him down. But once he became bloodied, he kind of got bloodied, meaning he was at half of his hit points. He got access to a lot of other powers and became a lot more just bigger and badder. And he started knocking them around.
Oh, okay.
So it got kind of tense there at the end, but they were able to pull out the final victory on a missed attack that did damage on a miss was the thing that killed him.
You can do damage on a miss?
Certain power, like certain daily powers. Even if you miss with them, they'll do half damage because you only get to use them once per day.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, it was fun. It was an interesting game experience. Kaylin's going to run a Pathfinder game here in a few months. So that's a much different system, but still kind of that swords and sorcery feel. So we'll see which one I like after we do that.
Maybe we can get Kaylin to come on and do a GM Academy segment.
That would be about great. Her Pathfinder game. Excellent GM.
She is indeed. Yes. So, awesome. Well, as far as games I've been playing, most of what I've been playing has been at Origins 2010. So, are we going to talk about that now, or are we going to... We're going to talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah. We're going to go through some emails, and then John's going to give us the skinny.
Okay. So, before that, other than Origins, I did have a chance to play Dixit with my family, which was very cool. And actually, I got to play a game with Cody and a couple other folks as well, but gotten at the table several times, and it's been a pretty big hit. I mean, I think it's good for non-gamers.
Certainly
and
different.
Good family. Very different.
Very unique.
Good for creative people, and I think for people who don't think they're creative, they might be surprised when they play that they're actually more creative than they think. One shout out I have to give to my mom, who doesn't listen to the show, but if she were... She is always very kind of nervous about games like that, you know, where that it requires a creative element to them, because she just thinks she's not going to be any good at them. But she had a card, and she just said that her word for the card was corn. And then everybody laid all their cards down and everything, and I couldn't figure it out at all. The only one that I saw was a card that had a picture of like a banquet buffet with a bunch of food and stuff on it. So I was thinking... Corn, okay. And maybe the fact that there was no corn on that card at all, maybe she was saying that. Well, no, when it came out down to the end, I was the only dummy who hadn't figured it out, which was good for my mom because she got points. She had put down a card with a picture of a maze on it.
Oh.
Get it? Maze, yeah. Corn,
that's,
yeah.
That was
pretty
top
good.
Shelf.
That's like... pretty top shelf. So we gave her the big pats on the back for that, and that made her feel real good. So it was a real hit all the way around there. So that's kind of what I've been playing, except for Origins, which we'll talk about in a second. So let's move on to emails.
That's right. We got a lot of good responses.
We did. We got a lot of good emails.
And some of them were on kind of the regional card game thing that we briefly touched on last episode. We have an email from Corey J. I'm going to say Grohlman.
Grohlman, yeah.
Grohlman.
Sure.
Let's do that. Grohlman. He says, in response to your prompt from episode 46 about family card games, I thought I'd share games my family has played since my childhood. Whenever we get together with extended family, it would be a shocker if one of these games did not get played. The first is just called 500, and it is played to...
500
points, that's correct.
Oh, good.
It's a partner-based four-player bidding trick-taking game. Other favorites are Hearts, Spades, and Garbage, which is sort of like Phase 10. I've not heard of that.
Boy, it might be exactly like Phase 10 if it's called Garbage.
Ouch.
Hey.
Since I got into hobby board gaming, I've slowly started converting some family members, one of which wins nearly every game, all the while complaining that she has no idea what's going on. Coliseum, Citadels, Dice Town, all the same cry, all the same results. I can put up with it as long as they continue to try their games besides the tried and true card games that we've all played for decades. Thanks again for the podcast. Corey Gerleman of Des Moines, Iowa.
Des Moines, Iowa.
That's right. Beautiful Des Moines, Iowa.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, our next email comes from Karen from Detroit, and she writes.
Hi,
Cody and John. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Karen.
I enjoy your podcast. I'm in Michigan, Metro Detroit. Our apologies. In case you're looking for geographic trends. Our families have always always played Pinochle, and we still do when we're with family. However, most of our friends who are not from our family connections play Euchre, many with no idea how to play Pinochle. Needless to say, we play both. I bought Tichu cards months ago, but still have no idea how to play. Hopefully, John helped you there.
You should know now.
Yep. Hope to see you at Origins. Well, okay. Karen.
Karen, I'm not sure if I saw you at Origins, but if I did, then cool.
He was the goofus in the...
I was the goofus in the bowling shirt.
That's right.
All right, so our next email is from Andrew Johnson, the 17th president of the United States.
Congratulations.
He said, hey there, Cody and John. I have to say, I really love the show. I was listening to a couple of past episodes and was psyched to hear your review of Through the Ages and Roll Through the Ages, especially timely because just the day before I was driving through New Hampshire and stopped into Myriad Games.
Live free or die.
Wow. I had spent, you've been there one more time than we have.
That's right.
Andrew. I had spent about 10 minutes trying to decide whether to buy Through the Ages or Roll Through the Ages and settled on Roll because of its quicker playing time.
How did Dan not sell them both on the spot? Come on.
And 19 other games,
that's
I'm
right.
sure.
Hey, while you're here.
Maybe he was off that day. I don't know. as you can see, because quicker playing time, he says, as you can see, I'm applying the Jones theory to civilization building games. Well done. I figured that Myriad had given it such a great review that it was worth a try. So when you guys released your review of both games, I was thrilled. Having now tried Roll Through the Ages, I have to say that it is a fantastic game and everyone should try it. It's way more fun than it should be. I kind of felt that way about the game, too. It's like, yeah. I shouldn't be having this much fun with this. And we've tried it with up to 8 people by photocopying the boards and using proxies, and it still holds up great. So thanks for the review. And he says, speaking of your reviews, I miss the general buy, try, or deny rating. Wouldn't it be possible to have both buy points and a general rating? I think it's worth adding in there as a general summation of your opinions of the game. And so far, your try points have boiled down to, if you like this type of game, you'll like this game anyway. So I think a general buy, try, or deny rating would be good at the end of each review, just like you did with Dungeon Lords. Anyway, something to think about. Love the show. Enjoy Origins. AJ. So, I'm fine with that.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think we made the change from just doing that final rating to these kind of buy, try, and deny points because we just wanted to make sure that we gave a good overview and that it didn't seem like it was, you know, just what Cody and John think about a game, because it's more important for you listeners to decide what you think about a game, and hopefully we can help you with that. But if our, you know, black or white or gray rating of a game would be helpful, then, you know, I'm willing to throw that back.
Why not both?
Why not both? Exactly. So thanks for that email, Andrew. And our next email is from a fellow podcaster and gaming maven, you will, Scott Nicholson.
Now my wife being a librarian, Scott Nicholson is like a librarian rock star.
Oh, I bet.
Like gaming and libraries, you know. It's like my wife knew about him not from Board Games with Scott or any of the other podcasts, but from his work with gaming and libraries.
Wow.
I thought that was kind of funny. I was like, yeah, Scott Nicholson, you know. I was explaining him to her one time. She's like,
I know Scott Nicholson. Yeah. Wow, it's a small world.
He does podcasts?
Okay, well, so Scott Nicholson, it seems like a heck of a nice guy. We've never actually met him in person, but
I respect the heck out of him.
Well, I do as well. So he wrote us and said, greetings. I was listening to your recent review of Through the Ages and found myself having a discussion with you in the car when you got to talking about the value of the game. I then realized that you weren't going to benefit from what I was saying to my iPod in the car, so I thought I would send you a note. Well done. When discussing the price of Through the Ages, you focused on the components that you got for $70. There was a brief mention of the depth of game design, but that was quickly put aside. Games are more than the physical components upon which they are printed. There are also creative works like books, music, or movies. The money you pay is also supporting the designers, artists, and others involved in the creative aspect of the game. You're not unique in this viewpoint. I hear many gamers focus on just the components when they talk about the value of a game. He says, what if this were the same criteria used for video games? Man, there's only a DVD, a small rule book, and a plastic case. That must cost about $1 to produce. How come they're charging $50? Or, boy, Picasso's work is overpriced. That's got to be no more than $40 for that canvas and paint. When dealing with creative works, it's more than just the components. He says, consider the depth of Through the Ages. The game took a very long time to create and balance, and the royalties for the game are what pay for the many, many hours that went into the development process. Instead of focusing on the components, think about the value of the game experience. Is it providing $70 worth of enjoyment? Is the depth of the design going to provide you with considerable replayability? Many of the games I play today don't offer enough depth or replayability, and that's what I consider a bad value. But a game that will come off the shelf again and again, that's worth paying for. And then he says, keep up the good work. Podcasting could be a thankless job. So, Scott, thank you so much for your feedback there. And it's an interesting point there about the value of a game.
It got me thinking, you know?
Yeah. So what did you think about that?
I agree with him in a lot of things. You know, I'm looking at the Through the Ages box right now, and I'm still like, $70? Goodness gracious. But, you know, what really stuck with me when he was talking about the playtesting, and that game probably had to be, how many times do you think that had to be played to get honed and balanced? I mean,
oh, a ton. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is not a short game. So I can see that. And I look at it almost as, you know, looking at it like a legacy price tag. It's like, how long will this game be in my collection? You know, how many hours of enjoyment will I get? Things like that. So it softens the blow a little bit for me. I worry that sometimes, you know, maybe we do get too focused on the chrome,
yeah,
so to speak. But it was a really good email. It made me think.
It's tough for me. I agree with it to a certain point, because I definitely agree with him that when it comes to the world of video games, that is a totally a front-loaded process. They put all of that, you know, they put millions and millions of dollars of money into hiring great game designers and computer programmers and buying all the technology that's required to be able to make these games. And then they make their money back by just, you know, spending a buck per game to just, you know, mass produce those things. And they make a huge profit margin out of it. And so I understand that when in a creative venture, that's part of what goes into it, is that hard work. But I mean, I think about things like books. You know, I mean, he mentions Picasso. That, of course, is kind of a convoluted example, but I understand what he's saying. But something like a book. I'm reading right now the second book in George Martin's Game of Thrones series called Clash of Kings. And that book, I'm reading like this giant version it looks like the large print, like it's the Reader's Digest large print version. But it retailed for $14.99. And so this book is about 900 pages long. I'm sure it took George Martin a couple of years or more to write this book. And to go through all the editing process. And there's a whole bunch of creative endeavor that goes into that as well. You know, this man spent a good chunk of his life, you know, a year or more of his life writing this book. But if they charged $50 or $60 or $70 for this book, I don't care how good it is. I don't think that's a very good value. You know, I mean, I know I'm going to get enjoyment out of reading it. But I think that the market can't really bear a price of like $50 or $60 for a book.
Yeah.
You know? And so for games, I sort of feel like it's true that I think you can have a little bit of leeway for a game like Through the Ages, where you can look at it and say, wow, a whole lot more went into this game than probably, you know, a similarly priced game that just isn't as good or doesn't have that kind of replayability. But I think the market is only going to bear so much, you know, that... A game that's, I'm trying to think of another game that's just a really, Teach You is a really good example of a game that it's a really well-designed game. It's, you know, it's a deck of cards, you know, you're not going to charge $50 for that just because it was a really well-designed game. So do you kind of see what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I disagree with the book example just because you can more readily share a game with people. It's really hard to share a book experience with someone. You know, it's like you can't just sit down and have kind of a shared experience, a shared time with it, you know?
Okay.
And the game keeps on giving. Yeah, you can reread a book, but that's a little different from playing a game multiple times versus reading a book multiple times. I'll say that Scott kind of talked me down from the ledge a little bit. You know, I was saying, oh, $70, that's completely unreasonable. Now I'm like, it may still be a little high for me, but I can see it. Although I wouldn't use the art as an example of getting your money's worth. you look at the art and you're like, what is this?
I know what he was. Kind of trying to make a point there.
The box is beautiful.
Yeah. I definitely a good point, a good discussion to raise. And I think that's something that is coming up a lot now, especially with the people like Fantasy Flight taking these big box board games and, you know, raising the price to $100. And a lot of those games, you know, you open up that big box and, you know, the components really could fit in a much smaller box, you know.
See Rune Wars.
And, you know, was that price elevated due to the great amount of playtesting and design that went into it? Or was it done, you know, kind of strategically as a marketing thing to, you know, because they know that people will pay for that kind of Chrome, you know, yeah. So.
And you could even spin that off, you know, not to do a mini big deal here. Yeah. You could spin that off into a, you know, should you always be looking for the best value for your games, or should you treat games more like luxury items and not be afraid to spend a little more on them?
Yeah,
you know, that's a whole another discussion.
Mm-hmm, yeah, that not a real clear answer to that one, but no. You know, I guess you know you vote with your wallet on that one. Yep. So Scott, thanks for getting the juices flowing on that discussion, and we really do appreciate you listening to our show because you know I listen to yours. Yeah. So. all right, what's our next email?
We have an email from Jesse Hickel, a longtime friend of the show.
Yeah,
and he disagrees with us on Dungeon Lords.
Oh, I'm not surprised. I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah. He had a few comments on some of our points for Dungeon Lords. The first, he says, I would much rather learn the game by participating than by sitting and listening to someone talk. You would seriously rather listen to someone tell you the rules for 45 minutes than be experiencing what the game will be like. Rules tend to go over my head if I'm just sitting there listening to someone. In that respect, I love the step-by-step instructions of Schwafel games.
Yeah.
I appreciate that they help you understand the game before you really get going. If you don't want to teach a game like that, don't. The recommendation to play the easier rules first is just a recommendation. I don't know about that. They hammer that pretty hard.
They did, yeah.
Yeah. The rules are all in the back of the book. Personally, I like the training. Point the second. I don't understand why people are so offended by the audacity of a Euro game trying to use a, quote, American theme. I think it's great that European designers are trying to use other influences in their games. I'm sorry you didn't know it was a Euro game before playing, but isn't that your fault for not doing enough research?
Ooh, ouch.
Ouch.
Ouch, Jesse, wow.
Man, it burns. Don't get me wrong, I completely understand why this game isn't for everyone. However, I really enjoy it. I would much rather play Dungeon Lords than, say, Agricola. Well, me too, I guess, because this game is entertaining. I know people complain that there aren't enough decisions, but I happen to like not being completely overloaded by 20 different options and 50 things to do at once. Glad you gave the game a shot, and I'm sorry it didn't connect with you. Thanks for the show, Jesse.
Well, thanks for your feedback on that one. It has been kind of rare on the 47 episodes that we've done to have a game that we both just really don't like. I mean, I'd have to go back and listen, but I think that's almost kind of a first for us to have a game that's well liked and so highly ranked that we just both didn't really connect with.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, there's plenty of folks that think this is an absolutely great game, and it just didn't really hit with us. So. And I did plenty of research that I knew that it was a Euro style game, yeah. But I even mentioned a couple other folks mentioned in our Board Game Geek Guild had some other discussion about this this topic in this game, and you know I mentioned I was responding to a posting by Joseph Cochran who he had said I have to take one exception to a characterization you made during your wrap up of your Dungeon Lords review. You said. He said, yes, he's paraphrasing, that Dungeon Lords had too much of a theme for a Euro, and that if you're going to have something with that much theme, you should give it more American-style mechanics. And he kind of took exception to the fact that, you know, something with theme, you know, has to be American-style. And when I thought about that, I really do agree that that wasn't really what we were trying to say, I don't think. Yeah. And one game that I played at Origins, and we'll talk about Origins in a second too, is the game Fresco, which is an example of a game that I think has a very rich theme and has Euro-style mechanics, and it's very well integrated. So I'm going to be trying in the next few shows here to get away from using that term so much. Mm-hmm. Just personally, saying something's Euro-style or American-style, I mean, I think that games have evolved enough now in the last few years that you have different kinds of mechanics that I guess fall more into an American or Euro style category. But there's also plenty of games like Dungeon Lords that are trying to cross those borders. And, you know, maybe we should talk about things in terms more of mechanics. If it's worker placement, call it worker placement. If it's dice rolling combat resolution, call it that. But don't necessarily call dice rolling combat resolution an Ameritrash thing because, you know, more of that crossover seems to be occurring.
That's a fair point. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, that was what we had to say about Dungeon Lords part two.
One final email for you, and this is a nice little wrap up here. You may remember a few episodes ago, Anthony Salvaggio wrote us asking about gaming groups, how to really, you know, he was looking for one. He had a particular situation where he was trying to find like-minded people to game with, and it seemed pretty tough, but he sent us an email with an update on his situation, and he writes, just wanted to update you. I took your advice and searched the forums for where I live on the Geek. I just happened to find a post by a guy who mentioned his profession, which was the same as mine. So I Googled him, emailed him, and we got together for a lunch. We found out that we have much more in common than just profession and stage of life. I made a new friend, and we will be getting together for some gaming. Thanks.
That is awesome.
That's great.
Fantastic. Yeah,
that's why we're here.
Yep. Awesome. So I think that closes out the email portion of
that's
our Game
right.
On Inbox.
And if you want to write us, please do so at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
That's right. And we would also encourage you to leave us a voicemail, which we will probably play on the air because we haven't gotten too many voicemails that's recently. Right. And that is 4138 Game On.
Do it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So are you ready to hear about my trip to Origins?
Well, sure.
Okay. Well, okay.
Okay. So just to recap, John was able to go to Origins this year. I was not, as I mentioned earlier.
Boo.
But John is going to tell us about everything he saw, everything he did and didn't do at the Origins Game Fair in beautiful Columbus. Well, not that beautiful.
It's okay.
halfway decent Columbus, Ohio. So when did you get in?
I left on Thursday. Now, I'll go ahead and preface this by saying that I took the whole week off. And, you know, so what? Why didn't I go to Origins earlier?
Why didn't you go to Origins earlier?
Well, because I had another thing that I wanted to get done before I left, and that is we took and ripped out all of the flooring in my downstairs and replaced it with new laminate flooring.
And it is beautiful.
Thank you. And Cody and Kaylin came over, and they helped rip up carpet and take up tack strips and all that kind of stuff. So very, very much appreciated that they helped with that. And then I spent probably three to four days, laying down boards and, you know, killing my knees and all that kind of stuff.
But installing laminate flooring, buy a tire tonight.
It's a try plus, I guess. I mean, it really, for the amount of work that goes into it, the reward is really, really great. I mean, we got we probably did, it's turning into a home improvement show, but we probably did 500 or 600 square feet of flooring in 3 days. Yeah. And, you know, I think it looks pretty good.
It looks awesome.
So I got that done before I left for Origins. So Origins was kind of my reward for, you know, being the handy guy around the house. And so I drove in on Thursday afternoon, and I got in about a little bit before 3 o'clock.
It's about a three-hour drive from Indy.
Yep, almost right at 3 hours. And I got to my hotel, and they didn't quite have the room ready yet, so I had to kind of sit and talk with some Southwest Airlines pilots and flight attendants that were sitting there saying, there's some kind of game thing going on. I got to explain that. And I always love being sort of the ambassador for normal gamers. Mm-hmm. not to say sound offensive or anything, but you know, there's so much about the gamer culture that is just sort of socially awkward people. I can't help it. There's just a lot of socially awkward people. So to have someone be well spoken about gaming, I think it helps the hobby. So I look for any opportunity to talk with normal folks and normal non gaming folks.
He then dismounted from his high horse and checked into his room.
Okay, that sounded bad. Anyway, just trying.
I know what you meant. Trying
to spread the love. So checked into the hotel and then walked over to the convention, got my badge and. You know, things were kind of in full swing. Now, granted, it was Thursday, so it wasn't quite as busy as it was Saturday.
Origins never really feels like it's in full swing.
No, I think that, and I don't have the official numbers, but I think about 10,000 people, 10,000 to 15,000 show up to Origins, which it's about...
It never seems like it.
Yeah, it's about a third to a half the size of Gen Con. But it's kind of a positive about the convention is that you never feel like you're just elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder crowded in the dealer hall or anything like right. that. So, and it's also good, especially as a podcaster, if I want to go and talk to a designer or talk to a publisher or something like that, I never feel like I'm having to vie for their attention. You know, can you talk to me for 5 minutes? Oh no, I'm in the middle of something right now. You know, they almost always have time to sit down and talk with you. So that's kind of fun. So I went in and got the badge, and the first place I wanted to make a beeline to was the boardroom. So I bought my boardroom ribbon. They moved the boardroom this year. It was upstairs last year in this kind of dimly lit nightclub sort of location. And this year they moved it down into the very end of where the dealer hall was. It was walled off, so it wasn't like, you know, in the dealer hall, but it was this separate area. But, you know, huge, tall ceiling. So it was a lot more noise and a lot brighter, you know, the fluorescent lights and everything. But the, you know, it's still in full swing, and the Cavs folks did a great job, you know, running it as they always do with their great game library. There's also lots of free games from Rio Grande Games.
Jay
donated a ton of those. So the moment that I walked in, I had two free games handed to me, and they passed out
Does he get a Cadillac for Dominion winning the Spiel des Jahres?
I don't know, man. But
they should have one.
I'm sure he's doing okay with Dominion being as popular as it is. So, and you know, to that end, in addition to the free games that you know people who had Boardroom Ribbons got, they also passed out tickets and had a big game giveaway on Saturday night. And in addition to that, they were also giving away free food. They had a concession stand there that opened for 2 hours at lunchtime and 2 hours at dinner time. Go in, get a full meal, no cost.
Wow. So just for Boardroom Ribbons?
Yeah, just for Boardroom Ribbons. So, you know,
that is phenomenal.
It was
great. That is great.
And someone had said something about it when I got there, and I was like, you know, do you have to, I didn't know how that worked. Mm-hmm. But I just got in line the next day for lunch and hamburger, french fries, drink, no cost.
Wow.
It was very nice. So many thanks to, I think that, I'm not 100% sure. I think it probably was Jay Tummelson that helped to fund that as well. So, if it wasn't Jay and if it was someone else who's listening, my apologies for not mentioning you, but whoever it was, we really do appreciate that. That made it a lot of fun. So I got to play a lot of stuff in the boardroom, got to check out the dealer hall. Those are really the two main places that I spent most of my time. There's lots that goes on at Origins and role playing. They have Terror Works, which is kind of like a laser tag on steroids and with airsoft guns and stuff like that. They had the big battle pods with
the battle tech
stuff.
That's gonna be at Gen Con this year.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. And they also had the big experiment, which if you remember our episode where we interviewed Andrew Looney from Looney Labs, he has this big thing where you get a ribbon for that. You can go play tons of Looney Lab games.
I was going to do that this year.
That was greatly expanded this year. In the last year that we were there, it was in sort of a like a conference room, like a big, you know, a big kind of a meeting room. This year it was like in a huge hallway area. I think it was where they had the auction last year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And so it was this huge open carpeted area where they had all the giant World War V game set up. And they had, matter of fact, when I walked in, they were Andrew Looney was playing an Everyone versus Andy game where they you basically sit at a table and you play. It's like, you know, 30 people. Yeah.
There's a good YouTube video of it. Andy versus everybody.
Yeah, and it's like 30 people each playing individually against or in small games against Andy. Yeah.
And different games, too.
And different
games. You know, he'll play Flux one thing, then he'll go to Chrononauts, then he'll do this. And
yeah, he'll play his turn, and then he'll go away and do play other turns. And then when it comes back around to his turn, you have a flag that you put up or put down or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back around and puts the flag back up. And so that's a lot of fun. So there's an army of Looney Labs fans that participate in all that kind of stuff. So Thursday evening, kind of afternoon into the evening, one of the first things that I did was I went to the Dice Tower Listeners Dinner.
Uh-huh.
And because
how did the listeners taste?
They were wonderful. And, you know, we didn't plan any sort of game on events, any dinners or anything like that. And so, you know, we're very, very good friends with the Dice Tower podcast. And so I wanted to go and meet a lot of those folks. And turns out we have just a lot of listeners in common. So I got to meet a lot of Justin Moore, who actually he and his wife came down and played games with you.
Yes.
I met Justin and Adam Brocker and some other folks. I also met Mark Zielinski and Mary Prasad and her husband, Ravindra. All folks from the Dice Tower had a great time with that. And then after that, walked back up to the boardroom where I was the co-host for the Wits and Wagers game show. And it's basically just like a huge team game of Wits and Wagers. I think we had 11 or 12 teams. And, you know, we would basically ask the question. Everybody would write their answer on the board and come and put it up on this large betting board. And we'd arrange them, and then there was like an easel and you'd write all the numbers on there. Basically just played like a big game of Wits and Wagers. And it was a ton of fun. And we really appreciate also the guy who every time he bet, he would come and bring fruit. So the first round, it was like he brought four clementines up, and then he brought in like two oranges, and he brought up apples. And then by the end of it, he dumped a huge bag of Hershey's Kisses onto the betting board. So you know, that was food for us to eat, I guess. But we had some fun questions on there. Like we tried to infuse some gaming related questions, such as what year was Dr. Reiner Knizia born?
Oh, I'll say 49.
1949?
Yeah. No, 1849.
Sorry. No, 1957.
Oh, 1957. Okay. Sorry, doctor.
Yeah, wow. And then the other question, one of the other questions was, as of, I think, June the 22nd, 2010, how many total reviews, video and written, has Tom Vassell submitted to Board Game Geek?
1,011.
Pretty close. 1,124.
Dude's a machine.
Crazy. The one question that was really strange was all the other questions came out of the Wits and Wagers Family Edition. And one of the questions was, how many ketchup packets can you squeeze into a 14-ounce ketchup bottle?
Oh, man.
And the answer was 56.69. And wouldn't you know, like, five teams picked 56.
Oh,
like,
wow.
I don't know how that...
That's odd.
It just doesn't seem
like
maybe
there's some math involved.
There probably is, yeah. But we were pretty surprised by that.
I have to say, I looked into the... I saw the rules for Gambit 7, you know, the European...
Yeah, the European version.
I like how they do... I don't want to interrupt and go into that, but check out the rules for that on Board Game Geek. I like the way they do it a little better than Wits and Wagers.
Just really?
A crazy aside there that really had no point.
Oh, I'm going to have to go check that out.
Yeah, check it out. It's pretty cool.
Okay, nice tease there.
Thank you.
After the Wits and Wagers game, which, you know, they gave out some coupons and stuff. There was some guys there from North Star Games. And so I had a great time with that. They gave out some prizes for that. And then I sat down with Eric Summerer from the Dice Tower, and he taught me and three other guys, including Colby Dotch, the designer of Summoner Wars, taught us how to play this game, Merchant of Venus, which I guess he talks about a lot on his show as being one of his favorite games. But it's actually a game that came out in the 80s and has never been reprinted. And so there was one user on BoardGameGeek who actually put together the artwork and everything for a kind of a reprinted version. So it's sort of a print and play. You can actually go and download all the files. Eric did this, and he like bought photo paper and made a nice shiny board and got cardboard or wooden tokens and dowels, and he used ice house pyramids for all the spaceships.
There you go.
So, you know, it was the full deal. So he taught us that game. It's a really interesting kind of space exploration and pick up and deliver game.
It sounds cool from what I've heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real solid game. So play that. And
Tom Vassell's dying a little bit inside.
I think so. lost terribly. He said he normally brings poker chips for the money, but that, you know, he was on an airplane, so that was going to be too heavy. Yeah. So he brought paper money with him from Muppets Monopoly. So it was a little bit strange to be like, you know, I'll take three gonzos, please. For
it's you mentioned the poker chip. I'm just going to be the derailer here.
Do it.
You know, I recently just bought a bunch of blank poker chips to use as money replacement for various things.
Mm-hmm.
And I got like 750 chips. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, this will be easy to carry around in store. I guess I never realized how many chips 750 is, or like the combined weight, because the shipment came in this ungodly heavy box. And so I've got all of these kind of poker chips sitting in a box. I'm like, well, how do I transport these?
Oh, so you got the chips but no container for them?
Yeah, because I found a place where I could get them really cheap.
Oh.
and just a blank color. I didn't want any real decoration on them or anything. So,
well,
yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah. So, again, a pointless
story.
Want
some Walmart sacks when you leave tonight?
Maybe.
That might help. So, after the Merchant of Venus game, you know, the nice thing about the boardroom is that there's always people there, even late into the night. By this time, it was probably after 11 o'clock at night. And so I was milling around and happened to find a group of folks, including a listener to the show, Todd Warnken, who was playing Founding Fathers.
Ooh.
It was a new game from Jolly Rogers game designed by Christian Leonard and Jason Matthews of 1960, Making of the Presidents, and Campaign Manager 2008 of that fame. And so this was the game I really wanted to play more than just about any others at Origins. And they were only selling like 20 copies a day. And then this guy happened to get one of them. And so we sat down and played. It was a four-player game. And it's a really fun game. And we will cover it on a future By Try tonight, so I won't go too detailed into it. But really cool components, and I just love the American history theme. It's about getting articles of the Constitution passed, you know, based upon particular political affiliations, Federalists and Anti-Federalists and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we're both pretty big American history geeks. I just finished the 13-part History Channel series, The Revolution.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so I'm like, I'm real jazzed to play it now.
Is it good?
It's good. Up in the first 11 parts are good.
Okay.
Well, after part 11, it's basically a year after the war. All of the British troops have gone home, and, you know, other countries are recognizing the United States. But I guess they had two other parts, so the other two parts are just kind of a flashback. As George Washington's writing to his inauguration, they pretty much just cram the first 11 episodes into the last two episodes.
It was the clip show.
Yeah, it was two clip shows. It's like, oh, and Washington remembers crossing the Delaware, and he remembers defeating Lord Cornwallis at the Battle of Yorktown.
And the scene like gets all wavy as it goes.
I'm like, really? Come on.
Man, that's got
I sad. Derailed it again.
That's okay. You did a great job. So play that one and really enjoyed that one. Enough so that when I left the boardroom that night, I'm like, I got to go and get a copy of this one. So, and I knew that they were only selling 20 copies. I knew exactly where the booth was. And so I'm have experience from Gen Con doing this kind of thing. So I got up early the next morning and I knew exactly where I needed to position myself outside the front door to be able to get in, to get one of these first 20 copies. And so in my mind, I'm thinking about Gen Con, like, the first day of Gen Con, when the doors open, I mean, it is a stampede of big nerds. And, so I was all ready for it, but Origins is a different kind of convention. And so when those doors open, I mean, I was the first dude in. And so I'm basically jogging down the aisle there and I'm looking around and noticing no one else is jogging. And so I was the first person to the booth. I got the very first copy of Founding Fathers that they were selling. So I felt kind of like a dork, I guess, for doing that.
Hey, you're at a game convention.
Yeah,
you know, how much of a dork can you be?
Okay. Yeah, I fit in pretty good.
You kind of top out at a certain point.
That's true. But I did get a copy of Founding Fathers. So, you know, Cody, we're going to have to pull that one out soon and give it a play.
Dibs on John Adams.
Okay, awesome. Walked around the dealer hall a little bit more after that. And then just spent most of Friday really in the boardroom just doing lots of board games. So, and I'll go ahead and do what Cody did earlier. And, I actually created a geek list on Board Game Geek, called Cody, Game On with Cody and John visits Origins 2010. And actually I was pretty impressed. I put the geek list up there and actually shot like to the number two spot on the hot geek list.
It's a very well done, much better than mine and, worthy of the top spot. So
thank you. So, I gave kind of an overview of some of the things I'm talking about here, but, one of the big nice surprises that I had during the convention was playing this game called Railways of the World, the card game. And this is, I'm not a huge train gamer, but I did enjoy the game Railroad Tycoon when it was out and in print. And they have now reprinted that game as Railways of the World. And I haven't had a chance to play that version yet, but I like the route building combined with, you have to ship goods and there's an economic aspect. It's a really fun train game. And what they've done is these designers, Steve Ellis and James Eastham, have come up with this card game design for this. And it involves all the same things that Railways of the Road of the World have, kind of minus the stock part of it. You're building routes and you're building cities, and then you're trying to transport goods with your steam engines to be able to get points. And it's really well designed. I was really impressed. I ended up playing it two times during the convention and buying a copy. And I also had the opportunity to interview the designers of the game. So Here's that interview with Steve Ellis and James Eastham. We're here with Steve Ellis and James Eastham, who have designed a really interesting game called Railways of the World, the card game. And guys, if you could just tell me a little bit about yourselves, just sort of your background and what you do and what got you into game design.
Sure. Actually, James and I are both engineers by training. And I've owned a retail store in Portland, Oregon for the last 12 years. I got out of engineering probably about 11 years ago, so I did a little dual tasking for a while, but I've been full-time in the industry, running a big board game store, and just kind of getting to know the manufacturers and things like that over the last 10-12 years, and James is still in high-tech, so.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm an engineering manager in high-tech. I work for a semiconductor company. I do a little teaching at Oregon Tech on the side as an adjunct. We've just always loved games. Steve and I have been buddies for a long time. The Railways game started out as a pretty basic core mechanic concept, so we worked quite a while. The game's been in development for about 3 years, so worked quite a while on just getting the basic core mechanics down. And what we wanted when we sort of started into this game design is we wanted something unique. You know, we talked about it and we're like, look, if we're going to do something, we want it to be different. And so what we've got is a game that plays spatially. It plays on the table, so you're building networks on the table. The game was not something that, the Eagle guys came to us and said, hey, we want a card game for Railways. So it doesn't feel like something that was just made just because we had a board game. This game was one that we had developed, play tested a bunch, and then we augmented it for for the Railways franchise. So it ended up perfect fit for the game. It feels like you're playing, you know, the Railways games. So the game plays spatially. You're playing cities out on the board, you know, and it sort of grows out on the table. There's some pickup and delivery aspects of the game. We also wanted something that was unique in terms of scalability. So not only is the game spatial, like I talked about, but you can get rid of all the goods production, all the engine upgrades, and then you just have a basic link control that you can break out with your in-laws or your kids that might not be gamers.
Yeah, and so you were saying that it's been in development for 3 years now. Did it start out with a train theme? Did you have a theme in mind, or was it mainly a mechanical thing to begin with?
Right, so the original notes that I have are just, you know, these basic nodes. So you can think of a molecule in your head where you have circles with lines connecting them, and the lines are colors, and the nodes are colors. So you've got yellow, green, blue, and they connect. And the first real prototype we did as a train prototype. So we looked at it and we're like, that's pretty cool in networks, right? So the original prototype was just one of building links to nodes and node control. And if you look on BoardGameGeek, you'll see a very early, just sort of a PowerPoint of an early prototype that just shows colored links going to these cities, right? And that actual game, you know, we floated it out to a couple publishers and they were really interested in it. But it didn't fit maybe what they were doing, but they sat on it for a while, play tested it a lot, got back with us and said the gameplay's great, you know. And then Steve and I were talking, and he spent quite a bit of time thinking about how could we add a little bit more to it, because the basic game, although it worked very well, was very simple. So, you know, Steve spent a lot of time, and we talked a lot about giving it a little bit more depth for more gamers. So what we ended up with is a game that you can still get rid of that complexity and play the basic node control, or you can add that complexity and get a real thematic railway game with pickup and delivery and everything else that you can play with your gamer friends as a 30, 45-minute filler.
Well, that was one of the things I was really impressed with, is that it does, for those who have played the Railroad Tycoon or Railways of the World game, it really does have that same kind of feel and the same sort of ideas, not the same mechanics, but same sort of ideas, but in a much more condensed format. Now, talk to me for a second about how do you get, when you have this great idea like this and this, you know, this design, for someone who might be listening who would be interested in designing a game and getting it out there, how did you guys go about shopping this idea out to different publishers?
So I'd say that the most important thing that up-and-coming designers need to know is that it's really, really important to make a professional, kind of slick-looking prototype. So that when you go to someone and say, hey, I've got this prototype, the first thing they see is, oh, it's got color, and it looks kind of cool, and oh, maybe I wouldn't hate playing it, right? You know, so it's, I mean, when you come with a black-and-white prototype in a plain box, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, here's another one, right? You know, I mean, so if you can give them something kind of slick, it doesn't have to be finalized art. They're probably not going to use your art no matter how cool it is, right? But it's really nice if you can give them something that kind of encourages them to open the box. And when they look at the cards, they go, oh, these are kind of cool, you know? And so they're a little bit intrigued and want to try it.
So did you self-produce a prototype?
Or? I did a prototype, and basically, you know, made it have all the colors and all the mechanics, and it wasn't amazing by any word. I mean, I'm not an artist by any means, right? But, you know, a little bit of simple graphic design just to kind of make it stand out a little bit, just enough so that somebody says, oh, that's kind of neat, right? You know, I mean, I can see playing with that. And visually, it's clean enough that it actually, it looks nice when you put it on the table, and it's just kind of clean and crisp so they can see it and get a feel for it. And I think the other thing is that you have to have a really, really concise rules set when you submit it, right? Okay. And it's also handy, I think, to provide like a little one-page overview of this is what the game is, this is our goal, this is what it does. And then, you know, if they're interested, they can read the, you know, six-page rule book or whatever, and they can look at the pieces and then decide, right?
So then do you just mail it in, or do you show it to someone at a convention?
The key is if you can bring a couple of them to a show, you know, meet some other designers, talk to the other designers and see who they know, maybe get them to play it. You know, it's nice to show up with, you know, someone who knows somebody and get a little bit of recommendation, right? I mean, for us, it was very helpful having been in the industry for 12 years as a retailer. Right. I had a lot of contacts, so it was easy for me to kind of reach out and maybe, you know, at least get some guys I knew who knew someone. And then, and at least it's not like here's a complete stranger, right?
With a little game box.
Yes, yeah. I think one thing, you know, to talk about what I've seen just at Origins this year is here's what not to do. Don't show up at a vendor's booth with a game that looks like you printed it last night, right? And try to get them in the middle of all this, right, to check out your game. I mean, like Steve mentioned, you come to the shows, but also one thing that really helped us is that, you know, a number of these guys are local. So we can talk to them, not at the craziness of Origins. We can maybe have lunch with them, you know, on some slow part of the year, right, and talk to them about our game. So I think that really helps, too, is find out who you got in your area. Maybe that's within driving distance. Set up a meeting. You know, do a little bit of networking.
So this is your first game design that you guys have done together that's been published.
Right.
Do you have any upcoming designs? Are you going to see what happens with this one first?
We have some concepts and some ideas that we've been tossing around. We're both busy guys. We've got families and jobs and things like that as well. So we kind of wanted to see how this one was received because we really felt it was good. And so this one seems to be getting a very nice reception here at Origins, which is encouraging enough to us that we'll probably go ahead and pursue some of our other designs and try to flesh them out. And I've had we've had two or three manufacturers at the show who are impressed enough to ask us to give them some designs.
So oh, that's great. That's
so
great.
That's nice.
Well, Railways of the World, the card game, played it a couple times here at Origins. I think it's a really great game, and so definitely encourage all you listeners out there to go and pick it up. And Steve and James, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Thanks a lot.
So that kind of goes along with the theme of our show here, where we're talking about sort of the little guy, the small publishers, and you know, so those guys are just two folks that are real passionate about what they're doing. You know, one of them's a game store owner in Oregon, and you know, with his friend there, came up with a really good game. So I would definitely encourage you to go and check out Railways of the World, the card game. I think we will definitely do a review of that in the future. So. And speaking again of games like that, we also played a game with a couple of listeners, Mathen and Brenda from Suffolk, Virginia, which is really near where I grew up. So, and we ended up in this, sort of the same booth together here playing Walkstar. Not Rockstar.
I got it.
And this is a really fun game about, and this is from a small publisher, about running a Chinese restaurant. And it's a cooperative game. But it really takes care of one of the biggest problems that I have with cooperative games, which is I hate the alpha dog syndrome.
Right.
Where you got the one guy who feels like he's got the game all figured out. And so it's just like, just do whatever I say, you know, and you end up with that one person who just says, just tell me what you want me to do, you know, and you don't really feel like you are participating in the game. You're just, you know, a cog in the machine that someone else is running. Walkstar is a little bit different because in the game you're trying to fill orders at a Chinese restaurant. And so you have all these recipes that you're trying to fill. And you start off with just a few of them, like three pot stickers, wonton soup, egg drop soup, that kind of thing. And each of those recipes has a certain number of ingredients that it needs to be able to make it. But each player is in charge of a particular recipe, and they're also in charge of stocking a particular ingredient. So there's a card that indicates how you stock that ingredient. The way that you stock ingredients is actually by a really clever little dice mechanic where you start off at the beginning of your turn and everybody rolls their dice at the same time. And that's sort of the pool of dice that you have to be able to obtain these ingredients. So, and so the element of this that makes this even more fun is that the game is timed. It uses sand timers. And so this sort of eliminates the ability for any one person to have this master plan that they're exacting and just having, you know, their fellow players carry it out, because you have to sort of make these suboptimal decisions. Once the timer's turned over, you have that much time to be able to fill a particular order. So you turn over like a customer card that'll say, this customer wants wonton soup, you know. And so then you look at the wonton soup, you turn over the timer and you look at the wonton soup card and you're like, well, I need chicken broth and I need wontons and I need these two or three items. And so then you've rolled your dice and then you have to place your dice onto these little cards to basically buy ingredients. So it'll say something like, if you use any one dye, then you can get one chicken broth. But then if you have a specifically this number, like a 4, then you can get 2 chicken broths. You know, you place that dye. Or if you have 2 dice that add up to like 8 or 9 or something, I don't have the game in front of me, but if you have that add up to a specific number, well, then you can get 5 chicken broth. And the board itself is basically just a tracker to keep track of how many of each ingredient you have. Hmm. And so you'll place your dice, move the ingredient tracker, and then you'll spend those ingredients to be able to build and make your recipes. And then once you've made the recipe, you can claim that card. Then the next one's turned over and you turn the sand timer over again. And there's 2 sand timers so that you can keep things kind of moving. I mean, I'm kind of going on about it because I really had a great time playing it. And it really feels like you're in this frantic sort of restaurant environment. You know, as we were playing, you know, Brenda and Mathen were like, you know, I need more chicken broth over here. Okay, I got chicken broth for you. Hold on, I got 2 more chicken broth coming to you. And you really felt like you were in the back of a kitchen, you know.
Hell's Kitchen, the card
game. It felt like Hell's Kitchen. Exactly right. I felt like Hell's Kitchen, the card game.
So. Where's the risotto?
The artwork is great. It's sort of like a Kung Fu Panda meets Mulan, sort of a cartoony Chinese artwork. And this is just a really, really great game. So, you know, I think they did a real small print run for Origins, but I would really, you know, encourage you to go and check this one out. So we'll post some information in the show notes as to how you can find out about Walkstar. All right. Well, I don't want to keep drolling on. I played lots more games and you can check it out on the Board Game Geek, geek list. I played in a Memoir 44 Overlord game, which we lost.
Well done. Did you spill miserably. Anything on the board?
Did not spill anything on the board this time. Well done. Did pretty good there. Thank you very much.
Proud of you.
And I also taught Eric Summerer and several other folks how to play Descent. And we used Cody's painted set of Descent figures, and it went real well. I just played the, you know, basic Into the Dark scenario, which is always
Narthak,
a good one.
Narthak
the Giant, yeah, who Narthak lost again, as usual.
That's what he does.
But it's really hard. I mean, I was really trying to win. I mean, I was really trying to defeat them. And
so you go in, you grab that gold treasure, then you shut the door.
Yeah.
You kind of get everything together, then you open the door again.
Well, and they were very meticulous about making sure that before they opened up a door, they were collecting everything. And, you know, and one of the characters had Mata and Kata, which are like the 2 ferrets that run around and can basically transport equipment back and forth.
Right.
So that made it really difficult. So they were really, really juiced up by the time they got to Narthak.
That's a good game.
It really is.
How did they like it?
I think they had a really good time.
Was it all first timers?
One guy had played before, and so he actually was very helpful as far as being able to kind of fill in the gaps on the rules that I had forgotten. But then we had 3 new players, and including Eric Summerer, who said that being the kind of the Euro style, I'm not trying not to say Euro style anymore. Being the someone who is very interested in the mechanics of a game and tight, elegant mechanics over theme, was not as impressed, I think, with the game as, you know, as someone who is more interested in the theme.
Right.
Anyway, so it takes a lot longer to say that than to say he likes Euro games.
Yeah, being a Euro gamer, he didn't like the Ameritrash game.
Pretty much, yeah. But yeah, I think he liked it. I think he also held a bit of a grudge because he was the only guy that I killed.
Really?
I killed him twice.
What character was he?
Isfer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the weird green thing.
Little green, yeah. With the thing.
Expertly painted.
Well, very well painted indeed.
So. Weird green thing.
Yeah, anyway. Anyway, played a lot of games. You know, one last thing I want to mention is I did get a chance to play Fresco, which was the only Spiel des Jahres nominee that I hadn't had a chance to play, and I really think I'm going to pick this game up. It is really, really well done. The theme is kind of strange. You're basically restoring a ceiling fresco in a cathedral.
Where do I sign?
But the idea behind it is very cool because you basically play a painter who has all of these little apprentices that are like your workers for the worker placement part of the game.
Does it beat Stone Age as far as worker placement?
Ooh, it's pretty close.
Okay.
It's pretty close. It's actually secret worker placement.
Ooh.
So you have like a little screen, and you have a little player board, and you place all your workers on there, and there's 5 different actions that you can take that you do in order, and then you basically reveal them. And so that's why, because it's secret, player order is very important as far as who gets to go first, because you get to resolve those actions before the next person does. Mm-hmm. The way that player order is resolved is you start off the game and it's based upon who is in last place gets to pick first. And what you basically will pick first is for player order is what time of day are you going to get up? in the morning? What time are you going to get up? And if you get up really early, well, then you get to go first and be the first one at the market. Like the first thing that you do is go to the market to buy paint.
Yeah.
But if you get up real early, then the prices are going to be higher. And you're going to be in a worse mood. So it's like a mood track, and your mood track goes down. And if
you're selling me on it now.
If you get up early too many days in a row, then the mood track will go so low that you'll start losing workers. That they'll just be like, I'm not getting up this early again, and you'll have fewer workers to place. So if you pick a later time, then you're going to be last. So you'll get the last pick of things in the market. But you'll get a lower price and you'll be in a better mood. So you have to kind of decide where you want to fall
like
on that
life.
Track. Yeah. So you buy paint, and then, you can restore these fresco tiles by paying the particular, paint cubes. But the interesting twist is the fact that you start off with just the primary cube, primary colors, yellow, blue, and red. And then, there's a step where you mix paints. And you actually will create green, orange, and purple by trading in cubes and getting the and so the fresco tiles that have the mixed paints are worth more points than the ones that just have the primary colors. So you're encouraged to mix those paints, and then at the very end, if you have like ticked off workers, you can send them to the theater, and that makes them happier. And then, so you can go up 2 points on your mood track by sending your workers to the theater. So
it might be one to look at. I've been looking to pick up, as per the Jones theory, a nice worker placement game.
I think this is a good one.
I've been kind of leaning towards Stone Age, you know, maybe Pillars, maybe even World Without End.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, that's yeah.
Well, I'll take suggestions.
I think Fresco is a real good one.
Really? I'll have to try it out.
I think it's real cool. By the end of the game, it really becomes a little bit, not a brain burner, but it's a real thinky sort of a thing of figuring out what order you want to do things to get mm-hmm. your maximum points. But I really, really liked it. So give a thumbs up to that one. Didn't win the Spiel des Jahres, but still yeah.
So you actually, you got it in a nice position. You played all 5 Spiel des Jahres nominees.
I did.
Which one would you have picked for the big winner?
Wow.
On the spot.
I think that I might have picked Dixit before playing Fresco. Mm-hmm. I think of the 5, I think I enjoyed playing Fresco the best. But these discussions that you hear on podcasts and on the internet and everything, a lot about the Spiel des Jahres, it's hard to get inside the head of the jury and figure out, well, what were they thinking? What are they going for? What's the aim of the prize? All that kind of stuff. So I think it's... I think Fresco is the most fun of those 5 games, and I think Roll Through the Ages is a close second for me.
Okay,
but I understand why they picked Dixit. I mean, it's something that can really be a good family game. Fresco is by far the most complex of the 5 games.
Yeah,
probably the most traditional Euro game out of the crew. However you want to define Euro.
That's right.
So one other thing that happened to Origins that was a lot of fun and kind of surprising is that, you know, they have different guests of honor at Origins, just like they do at Gen Con. And sometimes it's people from television or movies or, you know, geek culture. And this year at Origins, they actually had actor Brian O'Halloran, who you may remember from the movie Clerks, was the main character. He played Dante in Clerks. He was also in quite a few other Kevin Smith movies. He's actually been in a lot of different movies and appearances and theater and things like that. But he's also a gamer geek at heart. And I had an opportunity to sit down in sort of an interview capacity with him and talk to him about his background in gaming. So here's some of what Brian O'Halloran had to say about his background in gaming. Now, you may have already answered this before. What kind of games did you play growing up? Or were you mainly
D&D,
role-playing?
I did Champions, Space Opera, Call of Cthulhu, Top Secret, DC Heroes. A lot of it, you know, you name it. We did Axis and Allies, that type of board game, Milton Bradley type of thing. Shogun was mm-hmm. another favorite of ours. And it's funny, because I had a circle of friends that... Once we got, Iron Crown, actually, Enterprises, is the system, though, that we love the best because they're a critical hit system back in the day. And so we used that system and rule system for a friend of mine who we got bored of some simplistic type of modules that he started writing his own stuff in his own world. And he had in books and books and books of his own world and his own notes and characters and race types and all sorts of stuff. that we played that for about a good 6 years of his world and stuff, but using the Iron Crown rules. And then we all went to college and you know, different. We all got in our different lives and moved on. But we stayed a close circle of friends. And we always had the one friend who wrote the modules, the one friend who was always like, "Oh, yeah, I need to get this." Who's more the tactician? You need to get it done. Me, I was more about the characteristics of playing the character and actually, you know, I don't know, performing, I guess you could say, having fun while playing it. And this other guy would make sure we were all, you know, not breaking rules and stuff like that. And funny enough, in our later lives, it turned out to be like the person who was our dungeon master just won a Pulitzer Prize for his book last year. His name is Juno Diaz.
Wow.
So his writing, he went to Cornell for his master's degree, and then he wrote a series of short stories that got him very, very popular, and then he became a professor at MIT. And now he's doing a guest fellowship starting down at NYU, I think, this fall. But just last year, he won Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. So then my other friend, who was all about getting it done and all that stuff, became a cardiac surgeon, or became a surgeon in the military, and then became a cardiologist in New York. And my other friend, who was all like, "Let's make sure we're not breaking any rules, get along," was at one time a conflict resolution specialist for the New York City public school system. He's now living out in L.A., and I believe he's looking for his law degree. And I became an actor. Mm-hmm. So it's weird how the personality traits of what we did gaming turned out to be what we now make as a living. Mm-hmm. You know, and now my friend who won the Pulitzer Prize, he's now working on his science fiction novel, which is based on the science fiction world we gamed in. So to me, I'm like, this is freaking awesome that our game is going to be a book. You know, and I keep telling him, I'm like, "Bro, we got to then turn this into a game." You know, I said, "Look, gaming's still out there." So yeah, so I'm eager to see that. And that's the type of thing. Those are the type of games we played. You know, anything that was new. Like, our favorite system, you know, was the Iron Crown system, you know, for some reason. It just was a lot easier. We didn't, at that time, I think it was only version two of the rules was out in the late 80s, early 90s. I don't think 3 or 4 had even existed by then, of D&D. Mm-hmm. Although now I'm hearing they're re-releasing the game again with the original Larry Elmore art, in a new box set and stuff. I'm like, "Ooh, that'll be interesting." Mm-hmm. See how that comes out. I'll totally buy a new set. Because my books have faded and gone to somewhere. And, you know, when you leave it somewhere too long, your mother throws them out because you've left them in her attic too long. It's like, "Well, I didn't think you'd be wanting these anymore." Like, "Mom, well, they look like devilish books anyway." "I know what you're doing, spending your time in that basement all the time." My mother, my whole family's Irish. I'm the only one born here. So she still has the thick accent. She's like, "For a second, I thought you were gay, but you weren't. It was your brother who turned out that way. That was strange. You were spending your time with all the boys in the basement." "Mom, you didn't think that eating all that fried chicken and stuff, and when Burger McDonald's had the dollar Big Macs, we were all excited that we had a stockpile of food for a weekend?" "I know, but still, get outside with you. See some girls." "All right, whatever, Mom."
I also asked Brian about his role-playing game group and, you know, if role-playing helped him sort of hone his skills in acting and kind of move him in that direction towards the career that he chose. And here's what Brian had to say. And I think that what he had to say was very kind of poignant for, I think, a lot of gamers. I think he kind of hits the heart of where a lot of gamers are coming from.
But did you find that at all that as a kid growing up and as you had this desire to become an actor, I mean, Did that get sort of played out in your role playing? Did you find that as a way to sort of hone the beginning of the skills?
See, that was the thing, is that when I was gaming and my father was alive, because my father died when I was 15, he was an automotive engineer and mechanic, and that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And it was his death when I was a sophomore that really put me into a tailspin, because I hung around my dad like all the time. Mm-hmm. And so that changed for me, that, to be honest with you, that's what I threw myself into, was gaming, to leave the world of sadness that was the death of my father. So that, in a weird way, kind of like saved me. Excuse me.
And I think a lot of people do that. They game to get away.
So silly.
I'm such a geek.
Welcome to Origins.
I have no idea where this is coming from. That's the funniest thing. I'm like, what's this all about?
So I really enjoyed talking with Brian O'Halloran, and, you know, I would definitely encourage you, if you've never seen Clerks or you've never seen any of the other movies that he's in, you know, go check him out on IMDb and he's a really super nice guy. I was very impressed with just how down to earth he was, and it was really great talking with him. So be sure to check out his stuff, and he's got some other movies and things coming up. So we'll try to post some information in the show notes about that. But that was one of the highlights for me of Origins, was to be able to talk with Brian O'Halloran. All right. So, I mean, that's kind of my long-winded overview of Origins. I had a really great time. I got to meet a lot of great folks. Hopefully, if you saw me, you got a Game On button. I had buttons with the Game On logo.
I'm wearing mine.
Yeah, you are. It looks very nice.
Thank you.
I had a real good time, and Cody and I will both be at Gen Con and in full force.
Do you want to tell them about the Pulp Gamer Media Panel? That's the best time if you want to formally meet us.
That's right. Yeah, when Gen Con comes around, we've got a couple. There's a whole bunch of podcasting seminars that go on, and one of them is the Pulp Gamer. What is it called? Is it
Meet the Pulp Gamer Media Network?
There you go,
crew guys.
And what time is that at?
It is Friday at 10 a.m.
Friday at 10 a.m.
Yep, it's free. You can get tickets. You can probably just honestly show up.
Yeah,
it'll be fine. And then afterwards, if you'd like to say hello, just come on up. We'll both be in our garish bowling shirts. So
yeah,
just come up, say hi. We love meeting listeners, and that's a good way to kind of, you'll meet us. You can meet Myriad Dan. He can sell you a game. You can meet Don Dim. You know, all the other Pulp Gamer.
I think the D6 Generation guys might be there. I think they also have their own separate event, but I think they're going to be at that thing
okay.
too.
Okay. So. Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so convention season's in full swing. Origins was great this year, and we were a little concerned about it at the very beginning of the year as to how it was going to go based upon their kind of wonky registration.
Hopefully they get their ducks in a row before next year.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, the other thing, last thing I want to mention is that I also participated in the Origins No Ship Math Trade.
Oh, yes.
Which was terrific fun.
That's ship with a P.
Right, right. Yeah, with a P. And it's especially nice because it's no shipping. You can just bring the games with you and you trade them in person. If you never participated in a math trade, there's lots of information on BoardGameGeek about that. I would highly encourage it. It's a fun way.
I'm still trying to figure it out.
The next one that comes up that looks good, I'll sit down with you and we'll figure it out. But it's
math is tough.
We don't have to actually do any math.
Oh, that's good.
But it's a good way to take games that you're not really playing very much anymore and be able to trade them for hopefully some things that you will play. That's all I got.
All right.
I've been talking way too much. But
well, I will definitely be at Origins next year.
Awesome.
You've got my word.
Okay. Very good.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up the inbox. A sizable one, but it's nice to get the Origins report and to kind of know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the big deal. We're going to be talking with some folks from Stronghold Games.
The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big.
Well, welcome once again to The Big Deal, and on this episode, we're talking about, you know, you heard my Origins wrap up, and we're kind of talking about the little guy, the small publisher. We as the Your Common Gamers and the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer, we really want to champion small game publishers and folks who have a really good idea and have the gumption and, you know, the venture capital.
The gumption, very nice.
Gumption, yeah. Nice. And venture capital to be able to put their ideas into practice. And so, you know, we talked with the designers of Railways of the World, the card game, and we brought on to our show a new small game publisher. And we're really excited to be talking to him. So without further ado, we'd like to welcome Stephen Bonacore from Stronghold Games to Game On with Cody and John.
Welcome.
Who you calling small?
Oh, I knew I was going to get that.
Hey, guys, how you doing? Thank you for having me on.
Oh, really glad to have you here. So, Stephen, one distinction that I think you have is that not only are you a game publisher, you're also a longtime listener of the show, if I remember correctly from Game On Inbox comments of the past.
Oh, I've listened to actually every one of your shows from show number one. I listen to all the podcasts, I guess, or all the good ones, and you guys certainly do a great job of bringing up some very interesting topics and a very professional job of bringing your show together. So thank you for the great shows and for having me on, of course.
Well, how does your ego feel now, Cody?
Fantastic.
Oh, wonderful.
I've got the statue being built right now.
So we want to just start off today by just asking you. Just sort of of what your gaming background is. If you could just sort of give us your gaming resume and
cred,
your street
the kids
cred,
say.
Yeah,
that's right. We're hip.
And how you got started?
Okay,
that's right. Yo, lay it down.
I've basically gone the whole gamut of gaming. When I was a child, of course, the standard Monopoly and that kind of stuff. But then as we went through the 80s and 90s, you know, I started hitting the real kinds of games that you know, that gamers would call games. Went through some of the Avalon Hill stuff of the day. Axis and Allies was big with my group for a while. In the mid 90s. I was very into collectible card games. Magic came out, so I got into that for a bit. And Jihad, Vitesse, if you remember that great collectible card game, which is still out right now.
Vampire, John's shaking his head. It's Vampire the Eternal Struggle, of course.
Fantastic. There you go. Card game.
I'm probably the biggest of the three of us here. I'm probably the most noob gamer. So I don't know that one. But I know Magic, you know.
Yeah, good for you, yeah. Buddy.
Please continue.
I've continued to role play for my entire life since, you know, my like late high school days. And by the way, that's quite some time. I'm a little older than you guys, I bet. And
Cody is 73 years old, so I don't know.
He's older.
How you doing?
Also got into MMOs for a little while. I was into City of Heroes, but that was just for a short period of time. Got out. And basically, mid-late 90s, I basically found board games and really just started embracing those and decided that that was the kind of place that I wanted to do most of my gaming. And I found that the social aspects of gaming were the thing that basically appealed to me the most. So that's where I found myself in the gaming world.
So you're a gamer. You've established that. Good. That's good. That's good. We don't let non-gamers on.
Thanks for showing up, John. So you like games. Question two.
And so getting into talking about, you know, your company that you started. Now you live in New Jersey, right?
That's right.
Okay. And
the Garden State, sir. The Garden
State. Absolutely. And it is completely a garden in every place, including Newark, every place. lovely place.
That's what I hear. I've only ever been to the Newark airport, and it was lovely.
Yeah, I went to New Jersey once. And
that's all you needed?
I'm good.
Okay. Well, would you care to make any more comments about this man's state?
No, it's a fine state.
It actually is a great state.
Absolutely. Well, and so you have a business partner as well named Kevin Nesbitt. And who is formerly from Valley Games, and he lives in not New Jersey, but in Ontario, Canada. So, how exactly did you two meet, and how did this whole thing come about where you started Stronghold Games? You know, Canada, New Jersey. What was the connection?
Sure. Well, when Kevin started to, you know, leave Valley Games, I mean, it was kind of public, so people knew about it. And I just continued talking to him and just had conversations with him over time about, you know, hey, if you want to do something in the future, I would be interested. And at that period of time, though, I really wasn't in a position to do that. Economy was in bad shape and stuff like that. But it started evolving. Things started changing in my life a little bit, and it became a good time to start thinking about it again. So in late 2009, I reached out to Kevin again and said, hey, you know, you've got some great knowledge of the industry. I've got some business smarts myself and good gaming knowledge. Do you think you want to make this happen? And, you know, we thought about it and we went back and forth. We basically said we better meet if we're actually going to do this. So I invited him down to New Jersey. We went to Atlantic City. And we gambled a little, had some fun, and we looked each other in the eye and said, you know,
we're broke.
Can we really do this? Should we really do this? Can I trust you? And, you know, you look somebody in the eye and you get a good feeling like I did, and we decided to go for it.
In Atlantic City, after gambling.
Great meeting of the minds. I have it on my website as like the sort of the official launch date of the company.
Okay. Okay.
Every great decision has been made after gambling and at a casino.
Every great one that I've ever been a part of. Okay. And so you decided to form this company. And, you know, so what is sort of your mission statement for this company? What's your whole purpose and plan here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And we you know, we have a very specific mission statement, and we literally almost talk about it daily in the way we phrase things and the way we communicate what our objectives are as we're discussing what games we're doing and the specifications for a new game and why we're going to do a game. And basically the mission statement is this: we will only produce the highest quality, finest board games in the hobby game industry. Now, that's a very easy thing for people to say, of course. But let me break that down for you and explain why, you know, we live that statement. I mean, I mentioned the highest quality and I mentioned the finest. Well, quality to me is paramount given, because you're never going to keep a customer. You're never going to attract a customer if they've heard about, you know, bad quality. And you're never going to keep a customer unless you have absolutely the best quality components, the best quality game out there. So everything that we do, every time we specify a game, when we go to market, we care about how that quality of that game is going to be represented in the box that the customer ends up buying from us. And then when I say the finest game, I mean that on whatever level that a given game is coming out in. So what I'm trying to say is, for instance, the game might be the best game in theme, best game in mechanic. So we're looking at games that are best in breed, is a good way of putting it. And we're not going to bring out a game that is just, oh, okay, that's just a retread of something else. Or that's, you know, nothing more than you know, a bunch of old mechanics slapped together. We're always looking for something that is unique, or we can consider the absolute best in some category that someone would like. Of course, not every game is for everybody. You might not like a given type of game. But for someone who likes, for instance, deduction games, which is like our first game, Code 777, this is the absolute one of the best deduction games you will ever have. And I can say that because if you look at the geek and you look what people say about this game, they laud praises over it. It is like the granddaddy of deduction games. You know, you can compare it to the way someone would talk about El Grande being the granddaddy of area control games. That's the way Code 777 is to deduction games.
Wow. So when you're talking about, you know, the finest, and you said the best in breed sort of a games, I'm noticing that from what I know of your company, the tell us about the first three games that you're going to be coming out with. And I'm noticing that those are reprints of games that have already been out, like Code 777, right?
That's right.
So what made you gravitate towards that model?
That's another great question. I mean, Kevin Nesbitt, my business partner, I consider him essentially the brightest guy in the game industry. I can't say enough how pleased I am to have a guy like that, you know, to work with. And Kevin essentially created the business model of finding great reprints, things that have a built-in demand, and bringing them back to market.
Oh, that was kind of the Valley Games model, wasn't it?
It certainly was right in the beginning, and Kevin created that model. He's the one who brought that idea to Valley to his other business partners at the time, and then they embraced that and went with that. And the reason, it's really not an earth shattering concept, because if you think about it, if an unknown game company brings an unknown game from an unknown designer to the market, you're basically setting yourself up for failure. Nobody will know about you or the game, and therefore, why would somebody buy it? However, if an unknown game company brings a known game from a known designer to market, you have it built in demand, you bring it back with a very high quality, a very good game with a very high quality, and therefore, you have the recipe for a successful launch. And if you can do this a couple of times, you will therefore build a market, you know, and get some loyal customers back.
And now, what made you specifically choose these titles? I mean, if you could just maybe expound a little bit on these three games that are going to be coming out in 2010, and why did you specifically choose these games?
Sure. Well, with Code 777, we found that the game was actually about to be printed by another company in Europe under a different title, and we approached them to become the North American distributor for the game. We wanted to bring it back under its original name, Code 777, and we worked actually directly with the original designer, Robert Abbott, And we believed in this game because of its heritage and because of that we believed it was the best of the deduction games that were out there. And a lot of people wanted it back. So therefore, we decided this was a good one to bring back for the North American market. And we also will bring it into Asia as well. We don't have Europe. That's going to be concern that's in Europe doing it under a different name.
What, were they selecting code 666 or something?
No, they just wanted to rebrand it for some reason. So they're doing it under a different name.
Now, for folks listening that may not be familiar with the mechanics of that game, would you mind just going into briefly how the game works?
Oh, absolutely. There are 28 tiles in the game, and the tiles have numbers on them and colors from 1 through 7. And the distribution is like there's 1-1 in the game, 2-2s, 3-3s, etc., through 7-7s. And what happens is each player places 3 of these tiles in a rack in front of them, but they cannot see the 3 tiles on their rack. They can see the tiles on the other racks from the other players. So one at a time, the first player picks a card and reads a question on the card. And the card might say something like, do you see more blue sevens, more pink sevens? And then the answer can be more blue, more pink, or the same. And the same could be zero, or the same could be, you know, the same number. And by doing so, everybody else gets a little bit more information each time a question is read, except for the player that reads it. But then it's the next person's turn, and then they read another question, and you'll get information. And this goes around until you can guess what your 3 numbers are on the rack. You don't have to guess the colors. You have to guess the 3 numbers on your rack.
There you go. Can you tell us a little bit about the other games you have planned for launch? I know you have Confusion coming up.
That's right. And it's another good example of a game where we've taken the basic game and we've upgraded it substantially. Confusion, which is now we're rebranding it and retheming it to call, it's called Confusion, Espionage and Deception in the Cold War. Ooh. Basically, the game at its heart is an abstract strategy. But after playing it, and this is also, by the way, another Robert Abbott design, the great designer of Code 777. We played the game a number of times, and we realized that it really abstracts itself to a tactical war game of sorts. So we've themed this with a spy theme, whereby you have your spies on your side of the board, and the other player has their spies on their side of the board, and you're basically making your way across this abstracted map of the USA or the USSR to try to get the top secret briefcase from the center of the board over to the other side of the board to win the game. Here, by the way, is the big difference. In the mechanics, really a truly unique mechanic in this game, and that is that when I start the game, I do not know how any of my pieces move, and my opponent has no idea how his pieces move. And what I have to do is I have to deduce the movement of my pieces so that I can achieve the objective of grabbing the briefcase and getting it to the other side. So I would, for instance, take one of my pieces, move it forward 2, and look at the player, and they would say, yes, that is a legal move. I would then record that in my spy notebook, which is we're going to have this dry erase, very thematic looking spy notebooks, where on the outside it looks like a leather bound notebook, and on the inside you'll be able to cross the pieces out that you have ruled out until you finally figure out which one your piece is, and you can kind of circle that one then, and you'll know which piece you actually have that can move in a certain way to the other side of the board. And every one of your pieces, every one of your 13 pieces, moves differently. And it moves differently every game, because the movement piece, the pieces kind of are in two blocks, I guess, a larger block and a smaller block that sticks in the back of it, so that you will be able to randomize the movement every game, and therefore no two games will ever play the same.
Wow, now that sounds really cool to me, because I got to tell you that I don't like to make broad sweeping generalizations about games, but in general, I have not found an abstract strategy game that I like. And but this sounds like you've really been able to integrate a cool theme in with those abstract mechanics, and it really sounds like something that's really interesting. So I'm looking forward to seeing that one.
I'm really, really excited about this particular game. I mean, yes, because we've themed it the way we have, but And if you take a look on the Geek, and I hope the people listening will take a look on the Geek at Confusion. It's right now. It's you can type in just Confusion, and you'll see it there. And you'll notice the details that the artist is putting into this game to really make it feel very thematic that you are on a spy mission. I mean, the spy notebooks look very, very realistic, and the board, you know, with it's very dark, looking like, you know, you're in this espionage environment. It really is coming out well. Oh, and I didn't mention one thing: the pieces themselves. We're going to be using like very heavy mahjong density plastic, I guess you could say. So it's these really weighty pieces. So it gives you this really nice tactile feel as you're moving your pieces across the board. Very, very heavy. We've actually spent as much money on those pieces as many people spend on an entire game, because we want to really flex our muscles to show the high quality that we're going to be able to do with various games as we move forward.
You know, Stephen, how exactly do you I don't know anything about game production. You know, how exactly do you find sources for these kind of pieces? I mean, you know, all the games that we play, I mean, I'm surrounded by big stacks of games here that, you know, have little terrains, or, you know, you've got cool little tiles, are there normal venues and outlets that game companies are going to get these pieces made, like companies in China or wherever? You know, where exactly are you able to source these pieces?
Very good question. What we do is most game companies will put together a request for quote, an RFQ for a game, and we will send that to a number of various manufacturers, ones that come highly recommended. We won't go to anyone because we want to know what their previous cred is, you know, hopefully specifically in the game industry, but definitely in general in their manufacturing. And a little shout out I'm going to give right now to guys like Zev Schlossinger of Z-Man Games. Very helpful guy. I actually known Zev for many, many years while I was just a gamer, not a game publisher. Just a, you know, if you're not buying a Stronghold game, go buy a Z-Man game, because the guy is just a wonderful guy and he's always helpful.
He's a cool dude.
He's given me great information, and Keith Bloom of Fred Distribution, also a great guy. They've been very helpful to us, just in, you know, making sure that we can find the right places to go to. So between, you know, between friends in the industry and just doing some research on where the right places, the right manufacturers are, you team up with a good manufacturer, regardless of the country. Everyone goes, you know, you just find the right person. You don't always go for the cheapest price. You go for the one who you believe is going to produce the highest quality game, the game that you want, the game that we want to produce for our customers.
So kind of in that same vein, you know, say one of our listeners wanted to start a game company. What one tip would you say is the most important thing to get started?
All right. I'm going to tell you this really quietly. You got to come in close to the mic. You hear me? You hear me?
Yeah.
Don't do it.
He doesn't want competition.
He doesn't want competition. No, that's a smart businessman right there.
And that's not the reason I'm saying it. I do it not at all. I'll tell you this: if you're shy of hard work, if you don't want to be you spending every waking moment of your free time, if you don't want to make money, you know, it's a very hard business. You really have to dedicate a lot of time. Now I don't do this full time. I have a job that pays the mortgage and buys the food and all the stuff, you know, and buys my games. Stronghold Games is not going to make money for a little while. I'm hoping that in the future, you know, a couple of years, I might retire from other job and then, you know, do this full time. Several people who have been in the industry who did exactly that. They continued to work for a while until their game company was completely, you know, able to support them, and then they went, you know, the full time route. So but it is very, very difficult. And if the only thing I could say to people is, if you really want to do this, you really have to be prepared for a tremendous amount of work and a lot of people probably getting very mad at you for various reasons. And we haven't even gotten to the portion when we're bringing the games, you know, out to people. Hopefully, I mean, what we're doing so far and the prototypes that I've received, the pre-production pieces that I've received are representative of the quality that we're going to be putting out. So I don't think we're going to have the complaints that other people have had. But, you know, it's just a lot of work that you've got to know what you're going into before you commit to it.
So, speaking of money, because nothing is quite as wonderful as money.
Speaking of what you're not going to make if you're a game game publisher, right?
How can people get information on pre-ordering these games you have coming out and just getting more information on Stronghold Games in general?
Oh, thank you very much. Let me mention the pre-order for Code 777 is about to open up, actually. It should open up around July 7th or July 8th because our pre-order program is going to be a little bit different than everybody else's or other people's in general. Not only will you get like 35% discount by pre-ordering.
Wow. Pretty good deal.
Yeah, which I hope is a good deal. We are going to also absolutely guarantee that you will get that game before anybody else in the market. In fact, you should get it weeks before anybody else has it. That's our guarantee to you. And the last guarantee we're going to have is that we're not going to open up our pre-order program until we know that those games are on the boat floating over to my warehouse, which Ooh. Takes like 4 to 6 weeks, you know, to get that all geared up. So we're not going to play any games by like, oh, we're going to take your money. And then like, you know, 6 months, a year later, we haven't, you know, even printed the game. That's to me is cheating the customer. We are absolutely going to make sure the games are on their way before we open the pre-order program. And we're going to limit our pre-orders to 500 pre-orders because we want to respect our retailers as well. And we're going to guarantee you get that game first. And if you want information about the company, and this is where you're going to go also to do the pre-orders after about July 7th. And if you sign up for my mailing list, you'll get the information on when that opens up. And you'll go to www.stronghold-games.com. Make sure you put stronghold-games.com. That'll the guy who's parking that other website. I'll get it. Don't worry.
That's that New Jersey spirit.
There you go.
I got Guido and Sylvester on their way to his house right now.
Awesome.
But go to www.stronghold-games.com. And if you don't mind, sign up for our mailing list. And we will let you know when that pre-order program opens up. And we'll keep you informed of all of our releases. And we're going to have three releases. I didn't mention the last one, just very quickly, is Survive. And that game we've gotten huge accolades for reprinting this one. Again, it's almost a 30-year-old game, and the geek has been very, very receptive of this coming out. And that's going to be our Essen release. It's going to be a little later in the year, so maybe I come back and we'll talk about that one at that time. How's that?
Sounds good, yeah. It sounds like you've got... for lack of a better term, a plan, which so many businesses seem to lack, is a good plan. And you know, it sounds like you guys have really, you know, got everything lined up and for success. And you know, we're really excited about Code 777 and Confusion, and definitely Survive coming out later. And Survive especially because it's got, you know, like, you know, an island and sea monsters and all that kind of stuff. That's exceptionally fun.
It's got the island that goes away, and you've got your Atlanteans that fall into the water, and you've got to get them over to the outer islands, and the sea monsters are trying to eat them, and you got sharks eating them, and it's a lot of fun. That's my favorite of the three because it's Ameritrashy, and that's my thing.
We're really excited to have all those games coming out. So we invite our listeners to please go to stronghold-games.com and to check out the pre-order program for Code 777. We're so happy to have had you on the show here, Steven. Thank you so much for coming and spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Cody, John, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. I had a great time. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Nothing comes in.
All All right, now as a listener to the show, you may or may not see this coming, but we like to end every interview segment with what we like to call the final five.
The final five.
Thanks, radio guy. These are five questions that the gaming public is burning to know the answers to, so we are going to grill you on the spot right here.
Are you ready, Steven, for the final five?
I could be in trouble here. I don't know. I'm not sure I'm ready for this.
All right, well, that's great. That's a great position to be in. So, Cody, number one.
All right, number one, what is your favorite game?
War of the Ring.
Wow. Oh. Well, do you have the collector's edition?
No, you know, I don't. I said to myself, $400, other games. I might break down at some point, but I don't at this moment have it. I love that game, though.
I'll give you my address if you get it. You can just ship it here.
You got it.
All right, so number two.
What is your most hated game?
Oh, man.
The agony of the final five.
I know. See,
it's very real.
I'm not really a fan of like, oh God, what's it called now? Flux. I mean, I love the guys; they're nice people, but not a fan of that.
That is fantastic.
I feel bad about the Looney Labs now.
Don't feel bad at all. Hey, honesty is where the best of the final five comes from.
he was our first interview.
That's right. Andrew Looney was our first interview actually on the show.
He's a great guy. I met some of his staff.
All right, number three.
What is your favorite thing about the gaming hobby in general?
The social atmosphere. Absolutely. That's what drives me to board gaming, and I pick games myself that have a social element to them. And that's why the American-style games to me are more of an experience. So I guess that would be the way that I view myself. I want that social atmosphere, and I want experience with the players on the table.
That is the correct answer.
Well done.
Ding! Okay, and John's got number four for you.
All right. If you could play one game for the rest of your life to the exclusion of all others, what would it be?
Well, wouldn't that be my favorite game?
Well, not necessarily. I don't know. I mean, well, it's up to you. You can answer.
Hey, you're trying to break
like.
The final five.
No,
here.
You can't break the final
to break
five.
Break the final five. This is sort of like the final Cylons here.
we make no affiliations to the to any trademark infringement of any kind regarding the Battlestar Galactica series.
All right, no, I'll change it up just to mention another game, but. We're playing a lot of Battlestar Galactica here. My friends cannot get enough of this game. And it is truly, a real social experience game where the intrigue is so intense and so constant. And, it really is a great game to just be on the edge at all times. So I'll give my props there for Battlestar Galactica.
Another correct answer. Yeah, he's on a roll,
folks. No argument here, yeah.
you can tell he's listened to the show.
Yeah. All right. And
I'm answering him honestly for myself.
you've almost made it through. So now we have number five, Monopoly. Great board game or greatest board game?
Oh.
We broke him.
Yeah.
I think you've broken me. Monopoly was great for what it was for its time. Its time has long come and gone.
All right, so we'll just put you down for great. Okay.
I guess I have to be great if those are my two choices. All right.
Well, that was just for fun there. So, all right. Well, that's awesome. So you've survived the final five.
Congratulations!
Oh,
congratulations!
Oh, I need a beer now. Hold on.
Okay, we'll go get that celebratory beer. And thanks again for being on the show, Steven.
Thanks, right, Steven.
Thanks, guys.
Right, bye bye.
Buy, try, or deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple. All right, it's time for Buy, Try, or Deny. And as I mentioned in the open, we have a sequel of a game, somewhat. It's based on the sequel to Ken Follett's book, The Pillars of the Earth, and it is called World Without End. Playing these two games, I actually checked out Pillars of the Earth from my local library.
Did you?
The thing is a brick.
Oh.
And it's like this old paperback version that is apparently falling apart. Ooh. So I'm kind of afraid to read it. It was Pillars was apparently also an Oprah Book Club book.
Really?
Yeah, so I'm not... Yeah. I kind of... But anyway, the sequel to the book was World Without End, and keeping in tradition with the Pillars of the Earth game, there is a World Without End game. and has some similarities with Pillars, but also some differences. And John, our patented rules guy, is going to go over them with you now.
Thank you very much. World Without End is actually, you know, like Cody said, it's a sequel to a game. I have both of these games. I don't have either of the books, nor have I read either of them. So I'm not going to be able to give you really any background on the books or what they're about.
Nor do you need them to play.
No, then that's kind of the point I was going to make, is that you don't need these to have read the books for these games to be fun or to make sense to you. So, but the main idea of Pillars of the Earth, the book, as far as I can tell, is that it's this town of Kingsbridge in like the 1300s. That are building this cathedral, and the whole town's coming together, and there's like, it's like, you know, intrigue and there's power plays and all that kind of stuff, and it's just sort of this, you know, political family, you know, sort of drama sort of thing with, and they're building this cathedral that they're called the Pillars of the Earth. So now in World Without End, it's like the cathedral's already built, and here's kind of the flavor of the game here. It says, England in the years 1337 to 1361. Is that a vuvuzela?
Yes.
Okay.
It predates time and man.
Very nice. The momentous events of the English Middle Ages affect the lives of the inhabitants of Kingsbridge. Here, nearly 200 years ago, Prior Philip oversaw the building of the imposing cathedral renowned as the Pillars of the Earth.
Spoiler.
Now farmers, wool merchants, and builders, the players, strive for wealth and prestige. In the process, they encounter numerous and diverse characters from Ken Follett's acclaimed novel. The rivalry between the priory and the city merchants color the turbulent events of the time. Players must strike a delicate balance. You earn victory points for a pious and loyal life, as well as taking part in various building projects. You gain prestige caring for the ill during the plague. However, you still must eat before worrying about honor or glory.
Usually
you need to eat. Difficult times make food and income hard to come by, especially when the king imposes high taxes to finance his wars. Too often, you will keep very little from the money earned at the wool market. Your success may ultimately lie with the favor of the important people. Many trades balance life in the World Without End.
World Without End. We have a title.
There you go. So the point of this game is to win, and the way that you win the game is by having the most victory points.
What kind of game would you?
Oh gosh, this is a resource management game.
Oh jeez.
With a European flair.
Oh god. A certain joie de vivre.
Joie de vivre. Anyway, so in this game, you know, like the flavor text sort of says, you're going to be managing your resources and collecting things. You're going to, you know, be getting piety from the priory, and you're going to be getting goods, and then, you know, kind of producing things. You're going to be building houses. You're going to be contributing to these building projects. All these things, the point being to gain the most victory points by the end of the game. So it's a victory point game through and through.
Yep.
One thing that this game does have in common with the Pillars of the Earth is that it has the same artist, Michael Menzel, who is just a wonderful board game artist. And the board, just like Pillars of the Earth's board, is just beautiful. And the board comes with these kind of neat cardboard overlays, these cardboard tiles that are in the shape of different buildings. So you have like a hospital and a bridge and a little mill house and that kind of thing. Not Millhouse from The Simpsons.
Bart! This was very much like a Castle for All Seasons.
Okay.
The game that I won for winning a Dominion tournament, played it a few times and traded it away. It was
that good, huh?
It was just one for me.
Yeah.
But it has a very similar feel to that, although I think this game does it a little better.
Yeah. And the idea being that these building projects will come onto the board at certain times. You actually start off with the bridge on the board, and there's squares on each of these building projects where you're going to take your resources of stone and wood and be able to place them on there to help to build these buildings. That's going to get you victory points in the game. And so there's also a lot of other ways that you're going to get victory points. And you know, as I kind of go through the flow of the game, you'll be able to get a flavor of it. So the game is played out in a total of 24 turns. There's 4 chapters, and each chapter consists of 6 rounds. And so these rounds are governed by these particular cards, these chapter cards, that are put into 4 different stacks. They're in, like, you know, chapter 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then there's 6 cards in each of those. Now, there's more than 6 cards in each chapter in the game, but you only play with 6 of them. So that offers a little bit of replayability to be able to mix those up. The cards are interesting because they're square-shaped, and they're placed onto a particular place on the board that is kind of a diamond shape. And, you know, you're going to place the card there at the beginning of the turn, whoever your active player is. One thing that's interesting, though, is that you're going to be taking that action card at the beginning of your turn and orienting it in a particular way. Like, you're actually going to kind of place the card either sideways or upside down or whatever. And depending on where the points of that card are facing is going to determine what the different players get as far as resources. So the way that you sit around the board at this game is actually important. So you don't want to sit like two players on one side of the board and two players on the other side.
Right.
You really have to play with one person at each side of the board.
Unless you work out a system. You know,
oh, yeah.
Jerry is that, you know, location.
Yeah, I mean,
Marv is over there.
Don't not get this game because you got the wrong size table. You know, oh, we're not going to be able to play it. Because
I've got a triangle table.
We can't sit there.
What do I do?
So in a game round, well, the game setup itself basically involves laying the board out, which has a nice picture of the town of Kingsbridge, and putting that bridge cardboard on there. And then there's going to be lots of different chits, and you're going to be placing those onto different parts of the board and around the board, and then you're kind of ready to go. The first thing that you're going to do in a game round is you're going to reveal the topmost event card in that particular chapter that you're playing in. So the active player will turn that over. And then they're going to take this card, and the card will have an event on it of some kind of text on it and a nice little picture, and it'll tell you something that happens. And it might be a standing effect that will happen for a long time, or it'll be a one-time deal that'll just happen immediately. Once you resolve that event, then you're going to take and you're going to put the card on this little slot on the board and then orient it. Like I said, at each point of the card, there's going to be a particular resource. And so where you orient the card is going to show which resource each person gets. So once the active player orients that card, then everybody's going to pick up those resources. So the kind of resources that you can get are stone. There's a quarry, you can get, which is like a gray cube. You can get grain from the field. You can get wool from the supply. The wool tokens are kind of cool. They're sort of this. They look kind of like a white blanket made out of wood, mm-hmm. kind of like curved.
Like a fruit roll up.
Yeah. You might get a victory point, and there's a track around the outside of the board, so you just move your marker one there. You actually start off the game with 8 victory points, which usually is when you see that in a game, you know that I'm probably going to lose some points if they're going to give me 8 to start off with. You can also get medical knowledge as a resource. And this basically is these little cardboard tokens that have a picture of a book on them. So you might get that as one of your resources. They have wood from the forest, which would be a little brown cube. You can get piety from the cathedral, which in our game became pie. So I think I'm going to go to the cathedral and get some pie.
Nah, dog.
Yeah, that's what they said. You can get a loyalty token, which looks like a little crown, like a king's crown. So, and those can be used. We'll tell you what those do in a little bit. Or you might be able to get some gold from the supply. So money is an important thing, too. So once you orient that card, you'll see which resource is facing you, and you'll claim that resource. The game comes with little screens, so you're going to keep all of your resources secret in this game. So one other thing that you're going to do after you've received what's called your personal income is you're going to look at the card again, and on one side of the card, there's going to be a little red arrow, and that is going to point to one of 4 numbers that are on the board around the card, 0, 1, 2, or 3. This is going to determine what happens with the favor track. So at the bottom of the board, there's a little track. If you've played Pillars of the Earth, this kind of looks like the track that the master builders go on at the bottom. Mechanics completely different, but it looks sort of the same way. It's like a semicircle. And so in this game, you're going to have a token on that starts off on this track, this favor track. And you're going to look at your card at that little red arrow and see what number it's pointing towards. Then you're going to move your favor marker that number of spaces. And the active player is going to get whatever resource is on that space on the favor track. And these are things like there's a space called the Queen, where you would receive 2 victory points, provided that you have at least 1 loyalty token. You have the Prior, where you receive 1 piety from the cathedral. You have things like the Prioress, where you would receive 2 victory points, provided that you have at least 1 medical knowledge token. And you don't have to spend that token. For example, you just have to show people, hey, I've got 1 medical knowledge, and you get those points. So this makes for an interesting decision for the active player as far as orienting that card, because you want to figure out, well, what resource do I want, or what resource do I want to prevent my other opponents from getting? And then at the same time, when I do orient that card that way, where is that arrow? How many spaces is it going to move that favor marker? You know, and so there's a really interesting decision as to, you know, what you want to do there, because you you want to be able to move the favor marker in such a way that you're going to get the most benefit from it, especially since there's two spaces on the favor track called outlaws, where if you land on those, you actually have to pay gold to the bank. So otherwise, you're not even allowed to orient your card that way. So interesting decisions there. Decisions, Cody.
Yeah, Eurogame.
Eurogame equals decisions. So after you have oriented your card, gotten your income, and then done that thing with the favor track, then everybody is going to be able to play one action card. This is kind of the meat of the game, is that you're going to have, every player has 12 action cards, and there's 12 main actions that happen in the game. During the first chapter, you're only really going to use 6 of these actions, and then you're going to, and they're actually marked with a little star to say these are the 6 you're going to use. And then after that, in the second chapter and going forward, you'll use all 12 cards. But again, interesting decisions to be made, because when you play an action card, you're going to play one card face up, which will be your action. Then you have to discard a card and play it face down. So even though you have 12 cards, you're only ever going to do 6 things on your turn, on each round. So you will play an action card, and everybody will, you'll start with a player, the active player. And you'll play that one action card and then resolve it, and then it'll go to the next person, and everybody will resolve one card. And then that is pretty much the end of that round. So the meat of the game comes down to, what do these action cards do? So here are what the main action cards do in the game. So you have the grain card, which will allow you to receive 1 grain from the field. So again, you're getting more resources here. You have a piety card, where you get a piety from the cathedral. So the income that you receive from the action card, you only have control over that during your turn when you're the active player. But these action cards, you'll have control over this every time. So if you really need piety, then you might want to play the piety card to get the piety from the cathedral. You have a resource card, or I believe this was like the big typo in the game, that it either said resource or was it building material?
Yeah, building material.
Yeah. And I think like out of the 4 different stacks of cards in the game, one of my sets of cards said building material and all the rest of them said resource. Yeah. So but that means basically the same thing. It means that you'll get either 1 stone or 1 wood. Then the next card is the building project action. And this is where you can use up to 2 of your resource cubes to work on a building project. So this is like you start off the game with this bridge that has a few spaces on it for stone and for wood. You can take 2 of your resources, put them on that token there, on that project, and you're going to get 3 victory points for each resource that you use. So you have to use those to build on one particular project. You can't split it between 2. But that's going to be one of the main ways that you're going to get victory points in the game. The other projects in the game are going to come onto the board based upon those action cards. So things will slowly build up over time, and you'll get more and more things on the board. But to start off with, you just have that bridge to work on. And so that's one way to get victory points. You have wool and cloth sales. You can take your wool that you've gotten, and you can sell it in the market for a particular amount, for a particular price. You can usually sell as much wool as you want, but you can only sell 1 cloth. You'll get 2 gold for each wool and 4 gold for the cloth that you sell. So that's one card for that. And then you have a privilege card, which will allow you to repeat the previous action that you just did. So that's good if you want to do something twice. So those are the first 6 cards, and then those are the first 6 you'll use in the first chapter, and then the next chapter you'll start to use all the other cards, which starts to make things even more interesting. So you have house building, and you're going to start off the game with these little houses. They look kind of like Monopoly hotels.
Yeah, they reminded me of settlements from Settlers of Catan.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. They look exactly like that. So if you pay 1 gold and 1 matching resource, either stone or wood, then you can build a house on an open space in like the leper colony on the bottom left side of the board.
Rents are reasonable.
There's this section with all these little spaces where you can build houses. And it has a cost to it. It'll tell you what resource you need to build the house. Then it's also going to tell you what resource that house generates. And so the next card that you could use would be house rent, in which case you can receive income from up to two of the houses that you have. So you know use the house building card to build the houses, and then you can use the house rent card to receive resources from them. So you kind of get the flavor at this point that you're using all these actions to get resources. And in a second, I'll tell you what you're going to use those for, or what you're going to use some of them for. Definitely the house wooden stone you're going to be using on the building projects. You have a card called the donation card. And this will allow you to make a donation to one of the building projects. In a way, this is sort of like donating money. Instead of donating the resources, you're saying, I'm going to help to sponsor this project. And so each player gets these two little seals with the, not like art seals, but...
Baby seal walks into a club.
But like wax seals that you're going to place onto a building project. And you have to pay one gold to do that. And what that basically does is it, once that project is complete, even if you haven't put any resources on it, you're going to get some kind of benefit for that project being completed.
It's getting your name on the building.
Exactly, yeah. It's like
the John Richard Library.
John Richard Memorial Library. And you usually get a combination of victory points and some kind of resource by having a donation on there. The next card is cloth production, which you can trade in one wool for one cloth or two wool for two cloths. So the cloth is definitely more valuable than wood. Then we start getting into the last two cards. One of them is favor, in which you will move the favor marker exactly one space on the favor track and then receive the award that comes along with that. So if you see that the favor track is one away from something that you really want, then you might want to play that card. Then the last card is the medicine card. And this card provides you with a choice. You can do one thing or the other. You can either receive one gold and one victory point from the bank, or you can care for one of the plague-infected inhabitants of Kingsbridge. But this plague step doesn't happen until after the second chapter is over with. And so this is kind of cool because the game kind of tells a story. And so after you finish those two chapters... then these plague markers are going to slowly come onto the board. And when you start playing action cards, these little tokens will start to go onto the buildings. And it's basically showing that these different buildings are getting infected. Then you'll have the opportunity to use your medicine card to be able to heal these people in these buildings. So when you decide to do that, and I'll go ahead and just jump ahead, if you decide to heal the person in building number four, you're going to turn over that token and you'll see that maybe you need three medical knowledge to be able to heal that person or treat
Encyclopedias A through M.
Right. And so by playing the medicine card, then if you have that three medical knowledge, you can hold up the tokens and say, I've got three medical knowledge, and you will heal that person. You'll take the plague marker off, and then you're going to get whatever benefit was on that building. So, some kind of resource again, or victory points. And you'll definitely get victory points. You might get some kind of resource as well. So that's kind of a cool thing. And the nice thing about medical knowledge is that once you got medical knowledge, you don't lose it. You never have to spend it. You just have to show that you have it. And then you can do that medicine step. So that is all of the cards, all 12 of the cards. And like I said, you're only going to be able to use six of them during any one particular game round.
Decisions,
difficult decisions. And so you'll play through the first chapter playing these cards. And then at the very end of the chapter, a couple of different things are going to happen. You're going to add some resources to each of the building projects. So if no one had been working on the projects, the other people in the town will have done something to them. So you'll add some cubes to each of those. There may be some things that were covered up. Like at the very beginning of the game, the cloth market actually starts off being covered, like you can't use it. You'll remove any of those covering tiles. And then any of the long-term events that might have been sitting around from those event cards, you'll remove those as well. So it's kind of like wiping the slate clean after this chapter. But then the last thing you have to do is the hard part, and that is paying mandatory duties. And there's three of those that you have to pay or suffer the consequences. The first thing you have to do is as the rules book says here, you must show that you have lived a virtuous and pious life. To that end, you must pay two piety, returning them to the supply in the cathedral. If you only have one, pay one. If you haven't been pious enough, you lose 3 victory points for each piety that you cannot pay.
Aww.
So that's bad. Yeah. But then you also must perform penance at the start of the next chapter.
Myriadgames.com. Myriad Games presentations on iTunes.
well done with your penance.
Thank you. Thank you.
But in this game,
the
way you perform penance is that at the very beginning of the game, of the next round, you have to let another player randomly draw an action card out of your hand at the start of the next chapter, and then is discarded. So you basically lose an action randomly, and that's your penance that you have to do. So that's not good.
No.
And then additionally, you must show that you have enough food to sustain your, yourself. To this end, you must
pay. Why do you have to show it? You know, it's like if you just starved to death, then, well, obviously Frank didn't have enough food, but you have to show the ham before you eat it?
Well, you have to pay it. I mean, I guess it's to show that it's being consumed.
Okay.
To this end, you have to pay 2 grain and return them to the supply in the field. If you only have one, you pay one. And if you don't have enough food, you're going to lose 2 victory points for each grain you can't pay. And you must go begging at the start of the next chapter.
Well, sure.
And so the begging penalty is that you have to forego your personal income for the first round. So when that card gets oriented and it says that you're supposed to get some resource, you don't get it. So that's your begging step, which is kind of funny. It's like, I'm poor, so I don't get... So you know, the poor get poorer and the rich get richer, I guess.
World without end.
There you go. Finally, you must pay taxes to the king.
Oh, yeah. The man.
So the active player then rolls the tax die.
Yeah,
actually,
what?
There's actually a die in the game.
All right.
And that's going to have a number on it between 2 and 5. And so the taxation amount is going to be between 2 and 5 gold. If you can't pay your taxes in full, you have to pay as much as you can. You're going to lose 1 victory point for each gold that you can't pay. And then you have to go before the royal court at the start of the next round. And so the royal court basically...
at least it's not the people's court. Rusty and Judge Wapner.
Oh, Rusty. Is Rusty still alive?
Probably not.
Is Judge Wapner?
No. Oh. Well, I don't know. I'm going to say no.
Okay, I don't know. if Judge Watt really
they got a
the
gal
show,
doing it now. I don't really follow.
That's true, yeah. Anyway, so if you have to go before the royal court because you couldn't pay your taxes, then you only get to carry out 5 actions instead of 6 in the next chapter. So you actually have to play 1 action card and discard another, but you don't get to carry out that first action.
And in a game with only 24 actions from start to finish,
that's
big.
Yeah. So
huge. Okay.
what's a guy to do? You know, if you're stuck in that situation, you do have some protection against those penalties. So that's where these loyalty tokens come in. So the little things with what looks like a crown on them. If you pay 1 loyalty, you can avoid 1 penalty at the end of each chapter, regardless of the amount of your shortfall. You're still going to lose the victory points, but if you don't want to have to pay do penance or begging or go to the royal court, then if you pay 1 loyalty, then you won't have to do that. And it's 1 loyalty for each penalty. So if you totally hosed yourself on 1 round and you have all 3 of these penalties, if you have 3 loyalty, then you can negate that and you don't have to pay that
if
penalty.
If the king likes you, the king likes you.
He does, yeah. And so that's what you have to do at the end of that chapter. Then you go through the second chapter, same thing, repeat that. You'll have to pay those mandatory duties at the end of that chapter. At the end of the second chapter, then you're going to have your plague, where these plague tokens are going to start coming onto the board, where you can start using your medical knowledge to heal those. And then you'll play through. And then at another point in the game, the tower building project, which is like the giant tower on the cathedral, that's going to be played. That's worth buku points towards the end of the game. And I should say buku.
You did.
I can't help it.
Points without end.
And so then you're going to play through this 4th chapter. And so the game is going to end at the end of the 4th chapter. You're going to pay those mandatory duties, but there's not going to be any like penance or anything. But you will lose the victory points if you don't have those things. But then at the end of the game, you're going to count up your remaining resources. Every stone and wood is going to each be worth 1 victory point. And every 2 gold that you have will be worth 1 victory point. And it's not like a rounding up thing, too. You could actually have a half of a victory point in this case. But the player with the most victory points is the winner. It says that in the event of a tie, the winner is the tied player with the most piety.
Okay, tiebreakers are good.
If there is still a tie, the player with the most loyalty wins.
A Euro game with two tiebreakers.
And then the player with the most medical knowledge.
Three tiebreakers. Kudos to you, World Without End.
So that is, I mean, an overall look at World Without End. So it's very much a resource management game, mm-hmm. acquiring the right resources at the right time, you know, playing these actions in an efficient way so that you can get the things that you need to be able to generate those victory points. So, Cody.
Hi.
Why don't you tell our listeners about how we do our reviews?
Well, we do the buy or try or deny format. John and I are going to give
patent pending.
Patent pending. We're going to help you decide if this is the game for you. We're going to give you points that we consider buy points, which are great points, instant sells, the greatest parts of the game. We're also going to give you try points, which are kind of, you may need to feel this out and see if it's right for you. Some people like it, some people won't. And then we'll give you deny points to where we think that across the board it's just going to be a deny for anyone looking into this game. And then as per our listeners' email, we'll give you our personal little quick, you know, buy or try or deny.
Okay. So for World Without End, mm-hmm. A World Without End production, what are your buy points?
I have to say, I feel like I'm going through this gaming renaissance of late.
Oh, I like it.
I still really love Ameritrash games. You know, I'm not losing that. I still love Fantasy Flight, Dice Fest, you know, heavily themed, big production value, counters, chits. Love it. But the last 4 or 5 Euro games I've played, I mean, going back to Through the Ages, Valdora, things like that, I'm loving them. Like, I wow. And I loved World Without End. I thought it had... you know, to kind of put it into a buy point thing, you know, you have great production value in the board, the components, you know, the chapter cards. Everything looks very polished and it's very engaging. You know, some of my problems with some of the air quote Euro games is that it's just so stale and it doesn't really do anything to draw you in. And even though I haven't read this book and I'm not familiar with anything of the story, it really kind of drew me in and I felt like a part of the game. You know, I would say... that whole game experience is a giant buy point for me. And the other one being the orienting of the chapter cards, that is a really good idea. That's a really just slick idea, and I could see other games start to use it. But top to bottom, I think this game is just top shelf.
Awesome. I agree with you, and I think that I'll go ahead and start off like I almost say with almost every game that we review is I think the components are beautiful. The artwork is very, very nice in the game. So you really, even the artwork on the box itself, it's just a very pleasing look to it. So as you're sitting and, you know, if you're the kind of person that likes to sit and play with the cool pieces and, you know, have pretty artwork in front of you, this definitely fits the bill. One thing that usually bothers me about resource management games is that I always feel like I was gonna say behind the gun. That's a mixed metaphor there, but like I'm behind the curve. Like I don't have enough of what I need, and I can't get enough of what I need. So I got to make these agonizing decisions, you know. And some people really like that kind of game. You know, like Agricola is a game. It's a worker placement game, but where you have only like 3 things you can do and you have 12 things you want to do.
You're by default behind.
Yeah. And some people really like that kind of tension. For me, that just stresses me out.
Yeah.
And so I prefer games where I feel like I can control my own little world, you know? And so in this game, it's really good because you know ahead of time, those mandatory duties are coming. You know, you got to pay that gold. You got to pay that grain. You got to pay piety. And so, you're trying to get the maximum points. You're trying to do all this stuff. But it's like if you can just – I like the fact that I can just sort of keep my eye on, well, as long as I've got 2 grain, and I got to make sure I get that. I got to make sure I get the 2 piety. I got to make sure that I get the whatever gold, you know. And as long as I'm – it's like I sort of collect those things first and sort of set them aside, you know.
Yeah.
Now I can focus on other things, you know. Yeah. But I never felt in this game like, oh, I am just going to be paying penalty after penalty every single round because I was trying to get, you know, victory points. Now, there were some rounds where, you know, I didn't miss the mark on a couple right. things. But
it's not like Agricola, you know. We're not saying we dislike a challenge.
No.
But, man, it's just – you think with Agricola, you're just always just under the thumb, you know. You're just always kind of getting ground down and you'll probably end up with a negative score.
Right.
You know, it's just, yeah.
in this game, you feel like you're slowly accomplishing something. Yeah. You're building something, and you know, especially like the houses, you know. Yeah.
And each chapter is another day, so to speak. You know?
Yeah.
You can kind of get back on the horse. And
exactly.
There's a lot of metaphors. Fiddle-dee-dee.
But that's one of the things that I really like about the game is I feel like it's controllable. Like, it's you feel like you're really accomplishing something, even if it's small. So what about try points?
The only try point I could really come up with is that the theme may be a hard sell to some people, because when you say it's based on a book, you know, and you kind of, especially it's based on a sequel to a book, which is a sequel to a game, you know, it's, huh? You know, like when I first heard of that concept, I thought it was kind of odd, you know,
yeah.
You know, I don't know that many books that could really support a game. But I mean, I even think that's kind of a weak try point. I just could see some people, hey, this is a game based on a novel about, you know, 15th, 16th century England. Want to play? Even the most ardent Euro gamers would be like, well, I've not read the book, you know.
Yeah.
So just out there. Once you play, it's not an issue, but it's something that could come up.
Yeah. I would say for me, that's the biggest try point, too, is that accessibility. You know, mm-hmm. Hardcore, you know, board gamers, I think, you know, you hold up this box at Board Game Geek Con or Origins Boardroom, you know, you'll be able to find players, no problem. But you know, if you have your family over or whatever, even folks that have, you know, played Settlers or other kind of, you know, games like that, it just might not be that interesting to them. Yeah. But I don't know, the artwork might draw them in, though, because yeah, I think it's really pretty.
I think that once you know, if you do read the book, that it'll mean a lot more, because there's little quotes and snippets from the book, and you'll get it, because if you haven't read the book, and, you know, I haven't, it's like, what's with the cathedral? What's with the plague? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and if you've read the book, I would say that, you know, you probably will really enjoy this, because I think about it like the Game of Thrones living card mm-hmm. game, you know, I mean, we reviewed that quite a while back, but any of those Game of Thrones games I like because I know all the characters, you know, and so
or like Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That makes it a richer experience.
It's like night and day, I think.
Yep. And, you know, you can like something like Battlestar Galactica, and you can like World Without End without having read it, but it enriches the experiences if you have. What about deny points?
I haven't bought it yet.
Well, very nice.
Yeah, that's my only point.
Yeah, I don't have any deny points for this game either. And so just as an overall rating for you, what do you
Oh,
what
I loved it. It's a definite buy.
Yeah, it's a buy for me as well. And apparently the Spiel des Jahres committee agrees with us, because World Without End was actually the winner of a special prize at the Spiel des Jahres this year that they called the Spiel des Jahres Plus.
Oh.
They didn't define what that meant, but that's what they called it. So, yeah, it's a really, really good game. And I was actually surprised that I didn't see it being played more at Origins. I actually checked the game out because I wanted to just get some people together to play it. And then I was having lunch and some guy came over and said, hey, you want to play Endeavor? So I ended up joining that game, but I never really saw anybody playing the game, which is surprising. Hmm. So yeah, definite buy for World Without End. So that is World Without End.
Yeah, review Without End.
Yeah, sorry.
No.
All right. Well, it's been a long episode.
Show without end.
It's been like a show without end. I think it's time to end it. What do you say?
I think so.
All right.
All right, well, we hope you've enjoyed this gamer-size episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Definitely gamer-size, my goodness.
But we had a quite the buffet of things. We had interviews, yeah. We had a con reports, great stuff going on.
Tons of stuff to talk about.
As you hear in the outro, there's a ton of ways to get in contact with us. The chief way is the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
We love getting emails either based on show topics or topics you want to talk about or anything in between. We love getting that. There's also the Game On Hotline.
That's 4138 Game On.
I woke John up.
4138426366.
Well done. It's been a long night.
Yep.
We thank you for listening as always, and until next time,
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on pulpgamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.
Well, we have promptly started the Game On inbox, as promised.
What are you doing? I'm starting and kicking it to you. You're doing the Myriad thing. What is this?
I hate podcasting.
Me too. Let's
I hate
quit.
You.
Are we done?
Let's play Gulo Gulo.
We're done. Let's go play Gulo Gulo.
Triviathan.
Well, it is the Game On inbox, your best source of gaming news and information. And but as always, we're going to start off with a little bit of penance. And what? What?
I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. All right, this is it.
Okay.
This is it.
Well, it is the Game On inbox, your best. It's going to be one of those.
Yeah. All right. All right. So we're happy we're joking.
Okay. Business. Business. Yeah. Let's get into character.